check this out, man.
We're people gonna rise up, take what's there. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This week in radical history for the week starting September 1st. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info was found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the East Side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in radical history for September 1st, 1921, the Battle of Blair Mountain was the largest organized armed uprising in America labor history and led directly to the labor laws currently in effect in the United States of America. In a traditional fashion, President Harding would order federal troops in and they would drop bombs from planes to end the strike. Also on September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland, start of World War II. To quote Hermann Hesse, "Of course the soldiers who die in the war are worthy our deepest sympathy. Many of them did great things and suffered greatly, and in the end they paid with their lives. But that does not make them heroes. The common soldier, at whom an officer bellows as he would a dog, is not suddenly transformed into a hero by a bullet that kills him. To suppose that there can be millions of heroes is, of course, itself an absurdity. The obedient, well-behaved citizen who does his or her duty is not a hero. Only an individual who has fashioned his or her self-will, their noble, natural inner law, into their destiny can be a hero." Hermann Hesse. Lastly, for September 1st, 1987, protesting American arms shipments to the Contras by blocking military trains, San Francisco activist S. Brian Wilson loses both legs below the knees when the train fails to stop. Now that's a hero.
Monsieur R, Oria, Mr. Frankie, Kiki La Record, L'International, 2006.
This week in radical history for September 2nd, 1872, the Hague Congress of the First International is held. It is here that Marx and Engels determined it is better to kill the International than allow the growing anti-authoritarian influence to gain control. Under the thumb of Karl Marx, the Congress confirms the principal resolution of the London Conference and takes to task the anarchists and their, quote, divisive, unquote, activities, i.e. anti-authoritarian activities. It expelled the representatives, including Mikhail Bakunin, from the International on the South. Items for September 2nd, 1981, UN Human Rights Commission rules that Canadian Indian Act violates international human rights. The problem of the First Nation tribes in Canada and the gross violation of human rights and treaties throughout Canada fight on to this day. Also in 1993, San Francisco mayor starts arresting Food Not Bombs volunteers. Their crime, feeding the homeless. This week in radical history for September 3rd, 1860, William Walker, a U.S. citizen who once set himself up as dictator of Nicaragua, invades Honduras with his own private army. Once he arrives, he reestablishes slavery. Also on September 3, 1897, Emma Goldman begins lecture tour in Providence, Rhode Island, and speaks at two open-air meetings attended by thousands. The then mayor warns Goldman that she'll be arrested if she speaks at open-air meeting again. Despite the prohibition, Emma continues to lecture. Speaking of Red Emma, 12 years later in 1909, the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, prevents Emma Goldman from speaking anywhere in his city. Accompanied by Ben Reitman, Emma is attempting to exercise her supposed free speech rights in a short lecture tour in Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, and is harassed nonstop everywhere she goes. Also on September 3, 1915, Australia, Wobbly Tom Barker is arrested for his anti-war poster. Quote, "Workers, follow your masters, stay at home," unquote. Anti-recruiting efforts finally get him 12 months of hard labor, but he quickly released within 3 months following a series of fires in stores and factories. No cause and effect there at all. Also on this date in 1954, the Espionage and Sabotage Act authorizes the death penalty for peacetime sabotage. Also, Congress passes a bill to revoke the citizenships of persons convicted of conspiracy to overthrow the government. These laws that are so loosely worded that governmental abuse of this law abounds. Also on September 3, 1974, former Nixon attorney John Dean enters prisons for the Watergate crimes. Now he's a criminal attorney, proving once again that once you're in the team, you'll do fine, like criminals such as Ollie North or war criminal Henry Kissinger. Do the crime and you'll do just fine. Also on this date in 1991, 25 workers die in a fire at the Imperial Food Processing Plant, Hamlet, North Carolina. 19 were single mothers. A non-union plant, it had not been inspected by the federal or state agencies for 11 years. Despite 3 minor fires earlier in the year and other obvious dangers, the fire exits remained locked. One of the worst disasters of its kind, reminiscent of the Triangle Garment Factory fire in the early 1900s. Also on this date in 2001, South Africa, U.S. and Israel walk out of U.N. Conference on Racism. Of course they would. Lastly, for September 3, 2003, thousands log on to blow up a virtual bush. This online game, pitting defecating peace doves, the player, against American President George W. Bush, is attracting thousands of play a day, including American government departments. Launched last week by the South African student website Get a Life. Quote, "We're able to monitor where the hits are coming from," says Andy Hadfield of Get a Life. He adds, "The game is very popular in Germany, England, South Africa, and France. You win when Bush explodes into a nuclear mushroom, or lose when Rumsfeld's missiles hit your pooping doves once too often."
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature Norman Finkelstein, political scientist, author, professor, and activist, speaking on Gaza, where he has done an enormous amount of research and writing on the systematic Israeli massacre of the Gazan population.
I'm going to be speaking this afternoon on one aspect of the situation in Gaza, which I think merits significant attention because of the political role it plays. And here I'm referring to the human rights organizations, which have played an important role, not as much as we would want, but nonetheless an important role in deterring, to some extent, the magnitude of atrocities Israel has visited on the Palestinians, and in particular on Gaza. And basically, or the essence, the gist, the thrust of what I'm going to say this afternoon is, we're entering into a kind of crisis period now because the humanitarian organizations have effectively capitulated to Israeli diktat, Israeli pressure, the mailed fist of Israel and its supporters. And that last deterrent to Israeli ruthlessness, I think, has been significantly neutralized in recent years. And that goes hand in hand with the fact that internally in Israel, the main organization that has caused Israel problems, created problems for Israel, I think it's clear that organization has been breaking the silence. And breaking the silence also came under relentless assault by Israel and its supporters. And as a consequence, it was my intuition, which I found was confirmed, corroborated, when I was in D.C. last, which was about a week ago, and I heard Gideon Levy give a lecture in which he mentioned in passing, I think it deserved more than passing notice, that breaking the silence has been effectively crushed. Why all that's important is, as I've said, if and when there is another Israeli assault, in particular on Gaza, there will be no one to document credibly in the West, and those are two qualifications, credibly in the West, what Israel is doing, and that last obstacle to Israeli ruthlessness will have been removed. And that presents a real problem, I think. Let me just go quickly, because of reasons of time, I have to be much more abbreviated than I would prefer to be. The record of the human rights organizations when it comes to the Palestinians has been a mixed one. There are only a few younger people in the room, but the older people will remember that actually the human rights organizations is a relatively new phenomenon for a large part of the Israel-Palestine conflict. They just didn't exist. It was very hard to get any documentation on what Israel was doing. Amnesty International was really pretty much a marginal phenomenon until it won the Nobel Prize, kind of out of nowhere. It won the Nobel Prize, and that catapulted it into center stage. Human Rights Watch comes pretty late in the day. It comes in the 1980s. The Israeli human rights organizations, the formal ones, don't come into being until the First Intifada. When the First Intifada starts up in 1987, December 7th or 8th, 1987, it's always been a point of pride to me to say December 8th because Professor Chomsky was born on December 7th. I was born on December 8th. So I'm going to insist that the First Intifada began December 8th. He doesn't always have to hog the limelight. So when the First Intifada came into being, among the sordid aspects of it was Israel was engaging in mass torture and ill treatment of detainees. And the human rights organizations, for the first time, documented a phenomenon that had been going on in the occupation since 1967. It was known. It was documented by leftists like Leah Simmel and Felicia Langer, the human rights lawyers. But it was totally ignored by human rights organizations. Come the First Intifada, it reached epidemic levels, the torture and ill treatment, and then the human rights organizations acknowledged that Israel was engaging in systematic, methodical, those are their terms, systematic, methodical torture of Palestinian detainees. At a very high level, it was Human Rights Watch estimated that in the First Intifada, Israel tortured and ill-treated tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees. In general, the human rights organizations, you can make some broad generalizations about them. Number one, they rarely accuse Israel of committing war crimes, and in particular, they shy away from, indeed, they dread accusing Israel of targeting civilians. Number two, the human rights organizations, their publications on the factual side, is generally quite accurate. I think they preserve high levels of professional responsibility, and therefore you will rarely find in the Human Rights Organization publications, in the factual side, you'll rarely find outright, flagrant falsehoods. With the exception that I think after Operation Cast Lead, Amnesty International's professional obligation was corrupted, and I'll get to that. And on the other hand, whereas the factual side of these publications is generally very accurate, the legal side does not rise to the same standard of professional obligation. Basically, you have the factual side, what happened? And that's the responsibility of basically the field workers to go out, to interview, investigate, quote-unquote, alleged crime scenes, and then on the basis of their investigation to report back what happened. And then there's the legal side of the publications. The legal side is a lawyer looks at the fact set and then decides, was that a violation of international law? Was that a war crime? If it was a war crime, was it disproportionate force, indiscriminate force? Was it the targeting of civilians? And that's what the lawyers, the legal side of the publications do. Now, as you can imagine, between the factual side and the legal side intervenes the lawyers. And I don't think it'll come as a surprise to people in this room if I say that when the lawyers come in, the truth goes out. And what happens is that the lawyers, I think, are much less responsive to what the law says and are much more responsive to what politics dictates. And the result is often an egregious, a blatant, a shameful, and a shameless whitewash. Now, I'll give you some examples, a couple of examples from the period preceding the Israeli, the latest spate of Israeli massacres, beginning with Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09. So let's take 2006, the Israeli war with Lebanon, what Syed Nasrallah called the divine victory. Whether or not there was divine intervention is not for me to say, but surely Israel suffered a major setback in Lebanon in 2006. And as the war drew to an end, it lasted 34 days. As the war drew to an end, the war was already over. A resolution had been signed in the agreed to in the Security Council, and they were just waiting to implement it on the ground. The war was over. In the last 72 hours, when they were waiting to implement the UN resolution, Israel dropped as many as 4.6 million cluster bomblets on South Lebanon. It was the densest use of cluster bombs in history. And Human Rights Watch put out a very excellent factual report entitled Flooding South Lebanon, Israel's Use of Cluster Munitions in Lebanon. What did it conclude? What was its legal conclusion? It concluded that Israel, quote, in some locations possibly committed a war crime. In some locations possibly committed a war crime. Now, just let's juxtapose that with what the human rights organizations, including HRW, Amnesty International, what they say as a matter of routine, what they say standardly when it comes to either Hezbollah or Hamas, they'll always say right at the outset, actually they'll say it from the very inception of a war or an attack, they'll always say, Hamas, Hezbollah, they committed war crimes. Why? They said, we don't even have to investigate it. It's perfectly clear they committed war crimes for the following reasons. Number one, they were using indiscriminate weapons, weapons which can't target with sufficient precision a military object or combatants. They use indiscriminate weapons. And two, they were willfully, intentionally, premeditatedly targeting civilians. So that's the basis for their claim. Routinely, you couldn't find a single case, and I know it from having read all the reports, there hasn't been a single case where, when there's an outbreak of hostilities, the human rights organizations don't immediately, directly, unequivocally attack either Hezbollah or Hamas for war crimes on the grounds I just reviewed. So let's take now these cluster bomblets. Densest use of cluster bombs in human history, 4.6 million dropped on South Lebanon. Well, these cluster bomblets, they were dropped using an indiscriminate delivery system. There was no guidance mechanism to direct these cluster bomblets on their delivery system. Number two, they were targeting indiscriminately. They just blanketed entire towns and villages. Number three, there can't be any doubt, any equivocation, that they were targeting civilians. Is that my conclusion? No. That's the conclusion of Human Rights Watch itself and of the people or experts it cites. So let me quote Human Rights Watch. In the same report where they legally conclude that Israel was at most guilty of possibly committing war crimes in some places. But here's what their factual findings were. Quote, the staggering number of cluster munitions rained on South Lebanon puts into doubt the claim by the IDF that its attacks were aimed at specific targets, as opposed to being efforts to blanket large areas with explosives. We found scant evidence that would demonstrate there was any military objective. They quoted a UN expert as saying, quote, he had no doubts that Israel deliberately hit built-up areas. These cluster bombs were dropped in the middle of villages. It then quotes none other than an Israeli commander. What we did was insane and monstrous. They quote a UN humanitarian coordinator. It was outrageous. They quote a UN emergency coordinator. It was completely immoral. Human Rights Watch weighs in and says it was shocking and unprecedented. Insane and monstrous. Outrageous. Completely immoral. Shocking and unprecedented. But what's the legal conclusion? In some locations, it was possibly a war crime. When we came to Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09, it was a kind of turning point. Time doesn't allow me to go through the trajectory of public perception of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and it's a complex picture. But there can't be any doubt, in my opinion, at any rate, that Operation Cast Lead from December 26, 27, to January 17th, 2008, there can't be any doubt in my mind, at any rate, that it was a turning point in public perception of what Israel was doing, inflicting on the Palestinians. And in fact, the human rights support organizations produced quite a large number of reports which were very impressive in their documentation, very compelling in what they had to show. They did accuse Israel of using indiscriminate force, which is a war crime. They did accuse Israel of using disproportionate force, which is a war crime. But they shied away from that war crime which resonates most with the public, namely targeting purposely, intentionally, willfully, civilians. So let me give you a couple of examples. Human Rights Watch put out a report entitled Precisely Wrong, and it cataloged, chronicled Israel's use of drone missiles in Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. And it seems to make a very compelling case that Israel drone attacks were targeting not just civilians, but targeting children. So, just as a preliminary, you should know about the drones. They're operated on the ground. And it's not only that the operator can direct the drone, which has very high resolution cameras, but they can direct also the missiles when they're fired from the drones. The missiles themselves have cameras. And up until the last minute, up until the last second, when that drone missile is right up against a person's face, they can divert it. They have that capacity. So, let's take one example that is, that was reported by Human Rights Watch. On January 4th, 2009, an IDF drone launched a missile at two boys playing on the rooftop. IDF, meaning the Israeli army, IDF statements and media reports indicate no fighting in the area at that time. Given the optical capacity of the drones, the young age of the boys should have been apparent to the operator. So there you have two little boys playing on the roof. Israel itself acknowledges no military activity in the area. The drones are equipped with high-resolution cameras, and the boys were killed. Well, that's the factual set. What is the legal conclusion of Human Rights Watch in that report? These attacks violated international humanitarian law. These attacks violated international humanitarian law. It doesn't call them a war crime, doesn't even acknowledge that they were targeting civilians. It's as if a driver of a car deliberately runs down two children playing in the street, and he's found guilty of violating the speed limit. That was the magnitude of the crime HRW was willing to indict Israel for a violation of international law, not even a crime. Amnesty International, it said on the same question of these drone missiles, it says, quote, children playing on the roofs of their homes or in the street and other civilians going about their daily business, as well as medical staff attending the wounded, were killed in broad daylight by highly accurate missiles launched from helicopters or drones. Disturbing questions remain unanswered as to why such high-precision weapons, whose operators can see even small details of their targets, killed so many children and other civilians. Well, if you read the factual side of the report, it would seem, at any rate to me, that the only disturbing question that remains is, why do disturbing questions remain? It's perfectly obvious what happened. A highly precise missile targeted innocent civilians. Why is that complicated? Where is the disturbing question that remains? After Operation Cast Lead, as I said, it was a turning point, not just Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, but it's estimated that as many as 300 human rights reports were issued after the Israeli assault. The most devastating of the reports was the one that was put out by the United Nations Human Rights Council, the report that was chaired by Richard Goldstone. Some of you will probably remember. The Goldstone report, you might say, crossed a legal, moral, and political Rubicon. It really did do what no other report to date had dared to do. That is, up until then, the maximum that most human rights reports would say was that Israel had committed war crimes on the order of disproportionate attacks and indiscriminate attacks, with an occasional on the margins, an occasional deliberate targeting of civilians. But basically, the thrust, the big picture, the context was that Israel was engaged in a military operation, a military operation that may have committed excesses, that is to say, disproportionate attacks, indiscriminate attacks, might be culpable of excesses, but nonetheless, these were military operations. The Goldstone report put the lie to that claim. It concluded, and now I'm quoting it, that Operation Cast Lead was a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. Now, it's important to, so to speak, internalize or at least ponder those words, because they're saying Operation Cast Lead wasn't a military operation. A military operation means when you are targeting military sites, a military installation, or you're targeting a combatant. That's a military operation. But Goldstone said, or the report said, they were targeting the civilians. That's not a military operation. That's state terrorism. That's a crime against humanity. And as you can imagine, Goldstone came under huge personal and professional attack. He had several immunities which acted as, to use the Star Trek language, acted as deflector shields to the Israeli photon torpedoes. So, deflector shield number one, he was a highly regarded international jurist. He was not known to be a partisan of the left, let alone the right. He was a good liberal jurist. Number two, he was Jewish. And not just Jewish by fortune, but self-identified and proudly so Jewish. And number three, he was a Zionist, not as a label of a pejorative label or epithet. He was proudly a Zionist. He served on the board of directors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His daughter did Aliyah, meaning she moved to Israel for ideological national reasons. So those were three quite effective deflector shields. We will call them deflector shields 10, 9, and 8. Israel started to launch its photon torpedoes, and slowly but surely, the deflector shields started to collapse. Then they went for his jugular, his professional jugular, dredging up from the past his role in apartheid South Africa. He was a judge, he's South African, he was a judge in the during the apartheid era. Then they went for the moral jugular. They tried to deny him the right to attend his grandson's bar mitzvah in South Africa. The pressure escalated to a point that we're now entering the year, we're in 2018, so 7 years ago, it was almost as if it were a prank. On April 1st, 2011, we opened up the Washington Post, and there Mr. Goldstone drops a bombshell. He says, I recant, in so many words, because it was a murky statement by him. I recant, I take back the report. He claimed that he recanted because of what he called new information that had become available, but it's perfectly obvious and not difficult to prove, to demonstrate, no new information had become available. I go through it in painfully minute and tedious detail. And I have in the audience Amin Haddad, who has the painful task, the onerous task, of translating this tedious detail into Arabic. He's my Arabic translator, and if you ever need an Arabic translator, I would refer you to Amin Haddad, and I get 10%, that's what I think we agreed on, for every public service advertisement for you. It was perfectly obvious and easy to demonstrate. There was no new information available. Why did Goldstone recant then? Some people say the public pressure finally got to him and he capitulated. My own opinion, based on looking at the evidence quite closely, is, and I admit it's speculative, is he almost certainly was blackmailed. There was no other explanation. Everybody has skeletons in their closet, except Mr. Ziad and Mr. Your Ziad and your cousin? Yes, no. These are exemplary Palestinians of a different generation. But if you don't have skeletons in your closet, you always have a relative that does. Not commenting on the children, just speaking in generalities. And they got to him, I think, almost certainly. And he capitulated. And at that point, it became clear that if you're going to cross Israel, that you're going to pay a price. Israel was very unhappy at that Goldstone report. The Nobel Peace Laureate Shimon Peres called the report a mockery of history. He called Goldstone a small man, devoid of any sense of justice, a technocrat with no real understanding of jurisprudence. Prime Minister Netanyahu ranked the Goldstone report as one of the three major strategic threats confronting Israel, among them the threats being Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas rockets, and the Goldstone report. And that was not an exaggeration. You know, of course, the Israelis get the Academy Award every year for greatest dramatic performance by a state. But in this case, actually, it wasn't theatrics. It was real. Number one, after the Goldstone report was issued, Israel was facing a real problem with criminal indictments around the world. The participants could not visit foreign countries without being faced with the prospect that under what's called universal jurisdiction, they were going to be charged with war crimes. And number two, so long as the Goldstone report hovered in the air, it was very difficult for Israel to launch another military operation, which is like depriving Dracula of a supply of blood. So they were very angry, and they launched a campaign. The campaign culminated in their objective. The objective was achieved. The Goldstone report was recanted. As I said, after that, the writing was on the wall, don't mess with Israel. And then you saw with Operation Protective Edge, in 2014, the regrettable consequences of that Goldstone capitulation and the dread and fear that Israel now instilled in the human rights community. Operation Protective Edge was quantitatively, not qualitatively, but quantitatively, much worse than Operation Cast Lead. 550 children were killed in Protective Edge, 330 in Cast Lead. 18,000 homes were destroyed during Protective Edge, 6,000 during Cast Lead. It was a real horror story. If you want to judge the magnitude of the horror, I don't think statistics capture it as well as a single statement by Peter Maurer, the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Bear in mind As the head of the ICRC, he is by professional obligation, his job is to witness, to visit war zones. If he's the head of the ICRC, you can be certain he's been to Yemen, he's been to Afghanistan, he's been to Iraq, he's been to Syria, he's been to Central Africa, he's been to all the major war zones. And yet, and notwithstanding, and nonetheless, he visits Gaza. And he comes back and he says, quote, "I've never seen such massive destruction ever before. I've never seen such massive destruction ever before. Not Yemen, not Afghanistan, not Iraq, not Syria. Never before seen such massive destruction as I've seen in Gaza. Tiny little Gaza. It can fit into this room. And he's never seen such destruction before. The destruction visited on Gaza 8 times. 8 times since 2004. It's just 2 years after Operation Pillar of Defense. It's just 5 years after Operation Protective Edge. Never having a chance to rebuild. Still under that illegal, immoral, inhuman blockade. And still, never before had he seen such destruction as in Gaza. Nonetheless, there was practically no human rights reportage on what happened in Operation Protective Edge. As Ayman perhaps noticed, Mr. Haddad, it was the second shortest chapter in the book. There was no material on what happened in Operation Protective Edge. Human Rights Watch, after Operation Cast Lead, produced 5 substantial reports, many of them quite long. After Protective Edge, 1 tiny report, eminently forgettable, eminently worthless. The only ones who did weigh in significantly, I think the total number of human rights reports came to about, I would estimate it came to about 10. There were 300 on Cast Lead. It came to about 10, if my memory is right. Amy can check my footnotes, but I think that's pretty accurate. It was only about 10. And half of them, of those 10, were from Amnesty International. Amnesty International weighed in, but it weighed in with a complete, shameful whitewash. Very painful to read those reports. And the same thing is true of the UN Human Rights Council, the council which produced the Goldstone report, this time produced a report by this New York State Judge Mary McGowan Davis, which was really a scandal, an offense to our human faculties to read that report. In the time that remains, do I have 10 minutes? Okay. In the time that remains, I want to just document the claim I just made, otherwise it's rhetorical and not convincing. So what did these whitewashes look like? Number one, the pretense that there was suffering on both sides. Amnesty International, on both sides, civilians once again bore the brunt. The UN Human Rights Council, this commission was deeply moved by the immense suffering of Palestinian and Israeli victims. Well, what did the balance sheet look like? Civilians killed, Palestinians 1,600, Israel 6. Ratio 270-1. Children killed, Palestinians 550, Israelis 1. Well, you don't have to be a doctor or a physicist to figure that out. You can be an investor or work at Jerusalem Fund to figure that one out. Ratio 550-1. Homes destroyed. Palestinians 18,000. Israel 1. Again, you don't need that degree in rocket science to figure out the ratio. 18,000-1. And now you have to ask yourself, does that sound like, or does the phrase, once again, civilians bore the brunt on both sides? The commission was deeply moved by the immense suffering of Palestinian and Israeli victims. Do those phrases capture accurately what happened? 18,000-1? 550-1? Both sides bore the brunt, civilians on both sides. Now there's this claim they always want to conjure up, this formidable military threat posed by Hamas. Hamas, Hamas, as the Israelis like to say. Can you say it for us, because you are Israeli, you have to admit it. Say Hamas the way Israelis say it. No, that's not. They have the guttural H.
It depends whether
you okay. You got around that very diplomatically. That's why you can go in and I can. They conjure up this Hamas arsenal. And it always has Grad rockets, Iranian Fajr 5 missiles, and it all sounds really sinister and ominous. And it's always accompanied by these graphs and pictures, pictorials, which make you tremble. They send shivers down your spine as you contemplate this terrorist arsenal. But then a simple question comes to mind. They give you the exact number of rockets that Hamas allegedly possesses. They give you the quality, whether it's a Grad rocket, an Iranian Fajr 5, and so on and so forth. And then you ask yourself a question. If they know the quantity and they know the quality of the Hamas terrifying arsenal, they must know where these weapons are stashed. Otherwise, how would they know the quantity and the quality? They must know where these weapons are held. But then, if they know where the weapons are stashed, and they pose an existential threat to Israel, as everything always does, then why don't they preemptively just eliminate them? Israel has, by its own admission, it's launched already more than 100 preemptive attacks in Syria to prevent Syrian weapons from going to Hezbollah. Well, if it launches preemptive attacks in Syria to prevent or preempt Syrian weapons from reaching the hands of Hezbollah, why hasn't it done the same thing with these Hamas weapons? The answer, it seems to me, is perfectly obvious. Israel just plucks this data out of thin air, and then all the media organizations, all the think tanks, and regrettably, all the human rights organizations just repeat this Israeli propaganda as if it were gospel. There aren't these weapons, let alone this arsenal of sophisticated weapons that Hamas has at its disposal. You might say, well, how do you know that? So far, everything you say, it sounds convincing, it sounds logical, it sounds reasonable, but it's not proof. It's not evidence. Fair enough. I recognize different standards of evidence, and I would say this standard of evidence falls into the category of the speculative. But then we have what you might call the proof of the pudding is in the eating evidence. What is that evidence? The evidence is the damage that was done by this alleged arsenal of weapons. What was the damage? According to the UN figures, Israel fired 5,000 rockets during Operation Cast Lead. That's not a small number. Hamas fired 5,000 rockets at Israel. That's not a small number. What was the damage done? We know exactly what the damage done was, because the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs posted a war diary, and each day it listed the damage that was done the day before. I went through that war diary. I was curious. 5,000 rockets, one house was destroyed. One. That's a little bit perplexing. I don't know anything about military weapons. And even if I were blindfolded and I fired 5,000 rockets, I'd like to think I'd hit more than one house. I mean, not that I would want to destroy a house, but I would like to think I would have a better ratio than that, 5,000 to 1. How can that be? Well, Israel has an answer, because Israel always has an answer. They'll say, ah, Professor Finkelstein, we got you now. Gotcha. Because you left out Iron Dome, our miraculous, brilliant, genius anti-missile defense system. It has to be miraculous, brilliant, and genius because Jews created it. So you left out Iron Dome. Okay, I'll factor in Iron Dome. According to Israel, Iron Dome was only deployed among the major urban areas in Israel. According to Israel, 820 Hamas rockets came within the vicinity of Iron Dome. Iron Dome had an efficacy rate of 90%, the Israelis claim. 740 rockets were deflected or intercepted by Iron Dome. In fact, Theodore Postol, who's one of the leading anti-missile defense specialists in the world at MIT, he says, well, not 90%. It was probably closer to 5%, or it deflected about 40 Hamas rockets. But let's accept the Israeli figure. Let's accept 720 rockets were deflected or intercepted. That still leaves thousands and thousands of thousands of rockets which weren't deflected, because altogether there were 5,000. If you subtract 740 from 5,000, you still get 4,060. The simple fact is, they weren't rockets. They were enhanced fireworks. And the unfortunate thing was that Israel and Hamas had a mutual stake in pretending they were rockets. Israel, so it can claim that it was acting in self-defense, and Hamas so it can claim that armed resistance works. You see how afraid Israel is of our Hamas rockets? And so there was, as I said, there was a mutual stake in pretending they were rockets, but in fact they weren't. There was also no Hamas terror tunnels, but time doesn't allow me to go into that.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have, so we have to end it here.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
If we have information, we can defeat the enemy.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you. My shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we'll take another swing at the lies that maintain the politics of fear that mask the policies of empire. In the first hour, the power of nightmares continues. And then we'll uncover the cover-up on 9/11 with David Ray Griffin and Dennis Bernstein.
From the widows and orphans, the never hard-working man I oppress. So take your pace easy, go home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding.
In the past, politicians promised to create a better world. They had different ways of achieving this, but their power and authority came from the optimistic visions they offered their people. Those dreams failed, and today, people have lost faith in ideologies. Increasingly, politicians are seen simply as managers of public life. But now, they have discovered a new role that restores their power and authority. Instead of delivering dreams, politicians now promise to protect us from nightmares. They say that they will rescue us from dreadful dangers that we cannot see and do not understand. And the greatest danger of all is international terrorism, a powerful and sinister network with sleeper cells in countries across the world. A threat that needs to be fought by a war on terror. But much of this threat is a fantasy, which has been exaggerated and distorted by politicians. It's a dark illusion that has spread unquestioned through governments around the world, the security services, and the international media. This is a series of films about how and why that fantasy was created, and who it benefits. At the heart of the story are two groups, the American neoconservatives and the radical Islamists. In this week's episode, the two groups come together to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And both believe that they defeat the evil empire and so have the power to transform the world. But both fail in their revolutions. In response, the neoconservatives invent a new fantasy enemy, Bill Clinton, to try and regain their power, while the Islamists descend into a desperate cycle of violence and terror to try and persuade the people to follow them. Out of all this comes the seeds of the strange world of fantasy, deception, violence and fear in which we now live.
The Power of Nightmares, The Rise of the Politics of Fear, Part 2, The Phantom Victory.
In 1982, Ronald Reagan dedicated the Space Shuttle Columbia to the resistance fighters in Afghanistan.
Just as the Columbia, we think, represents man's finest aspirations in the field of science and technology, so too does the struggle of the Afghan people represent man's highest aspirations for freedom. I am dedicating, on behalf of the American people, the March 22nd launch of the Columbia to the people of Afghanistan.
Since 1979, the Mujahideen resistance had been fighting a vicious war in Afghanistan against the Soviet invasion. But now, a small group in the Reagan White House saw in these fighters a way of achieving their vision of transforming the world. To them, they were not just nationalists. They were freedom fighters who could bring down the Soviet Union and help spread democracy around the world. It was called the Reagan Doctrine.
It was a small group of people, and yes, we did have. Everybody thinks, oh, the Reagan Doctrine, the Reagan administration, like everybody was for it. No, it was a small little cabal within the Soviet, within the Reagan White House that really pulled this off.
Jack Wheeler, advisor to the Reagan White House, 1981 through 84.
What united this small group of ours was the vision of bringing more freedom to the world, more security to the world, to actually get rid of the Soviet Union itself. As a result, supporting the freedom fighters became the premier cause for the entire conservative movement during the Reagan years.
But the Americans were setting out to defeat a mythological enemy. As last week's episode showed, the neoconservatives, who were now in power in Reagan's White House, had created an exaggerated and distorted vision of the Soviet Union as the source of all evil in the world. One of their main influences were the theories of the philosopher Leo Strauss. He believed that liberal societies needed simple, powerful myths to inspire and unite the people. And in the 1970s, the neoconservatives had done just this. Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, and other neoconservatives had set out to reassert the myth of America as a unique country whose destiny was to struggle against evil throughout the world. Now in power, they had come to believe this myth. They saw themselves as revolutionaries who were going to transform the world, starting with the defeat of the evil empire.
We're closer to being revolutionaries than conservatives in the sense that we want to change some deeply entrenched notions about the proper role of American power in the world.
Richard Perle, Assistant Secretary of Defense, 1981 through 1987.
We want to see that power used constructively and to enlarge the opportunity for decent governance around the world. We're not happy about the old cozy relationships with dictators.
And the man who was going to help the neoconservatives do this was the new head of the CIA, William Casey. He was convinced that Afghanistan was one of the keys to this aggressive new policy. America was already sending limited amounts of aid to the Mujahideen. But now, Casey ordered one of his agents to go and form an alliance with the freedom fighters and give them as much money as they wanted and the most sophisticated weapons to defeat the Soviet military forces.
for Casey, Afghanistan seemed to be possibly one of the keys. And so he tapped me one day to go. He says, I want you to go out to Afghanistan. I want you to go next month, and I will give you whatever you need to win. Yeah, he said, I want you to go there and win.
Milton Bearden, CIA Field Officer, Afghanistan, 1985-89.
As opposed to, let's go there and bleed these guys, make it be a Vietnam, I want you to go there and win whatever you need you can have. He gave me the Stinger missiles and $1 billion.
Yellow is the color of my true love's hair in the morning when we rise. In the morning when we rise. That's the time.
That's the time.
That's the time.
That's the time.
American money and weapons now began to pour across the Pakistan border into Afghanistan. CIA agents trained the Mujahideen in the techniques of assassination and terror, including car bombing. And they gave them satellite images of Russian troops to help in their attacks. At the very same time, another group began to arrive in Afghanistan to fight alongside the Mujahideen. They were Arabs from across the Middle East who had been told by their religious leaders that their duty was to go and free Muslim lands from the Soviet invader.
Abdullah Anas, General Commander, Afghan Arabs, Northern Afghanistan, 1984-89.
I saw the fatwa, the order, saying that every Muslim has a duty to help the Afghans to liberate their land. But I had no idea where is this Afghanistan, how can I go there. I've never heard about Afghanistan. I've never heard in the map which airline goes there, where can I take the visa. It 100 question. But I did meet Abdullah Azam.
Abdullah Azam was a charismatic religious leader who had begun to organize the Arab volunteers in Afghanistan. He had set up what he called the Services Bureau in Peshawar on the Afghan border. It became the headquarters of an international brigade of Arab fighters. Azam quickly became one of the most powerful figures in the battle against the Soviets. He was allowed to visit America on many occasions, both to raise funds and recruit volunteers for the jihad.
Dr. Azam Tamimi, Institute of Islamic Political Thought.
Well, Abdullah Azam became so instrumental in marketing the Afghan cause among the Arabs. He became very important. He became called the Emir of the Arab Mujahideen, the leader of the Arab Mujahideen. And he set up an office in Peshawar, which provided services to Arabs who came and wanted to participate in the jihad. When all doors closed, all doors were opened because the Americans, the Saudis, the Pakistanis, many other people wanted the Soviet Union to lose in Afghanistan and to be humiliated. That brought about huge numbers of Arabs from different backgrounds in the jihad in Afghanistan. He went to America, he went to Saudi Arabia, he traveled wherever he wanted because the Afghan cause was a cause that everybody was happy supporting.
But like the neoconservatives, Azam also saw the struggle against the Soviets as just the first step in a much wider revolution. He was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, who wanted Islam to play a political role in governing Muslim societies. And Abdullah Azam believed that the Arabs in Afghanistan could be the nucleus of a new political force. They would return to their own countries and persuade the people to reject the corrupt, autocratic regimes that dominated the Middle East. But these regimes, Azam insisted, must be overthrown by political means. He made every fighter pledged they would not use terrorism against civilians in the pursuit of their vision. One of Azam's closest aides was a Saudi, Osama bin Laden.
Abdullah Anas.
Osama came to participate in 85. When he came, he came from a rich family from Saudi, and he had much money to spend. Sheikh Abdullah Azam was a scholar. He can organize the Afghans, but he is not a rich man. So when Osama came, he filled in this gap. So the main duty of Osama in that time was spending money. Beside his good personal qualities.
But then, in 1985, a new force began to arrive in Afghanistan who were going to challenge Azam's approach. They were the extreme radical Islamists who were being expelled from prisons across the Arab world.
And then, very quietly, most of the governments in the Middle East, the Arab governments, began to empty their prisons of their bad guys.
Milton Bearden, CIA field officer.
And send them off to the jihad with the very fondest hope that they become martyred. Many of them were the people in Egypt that had not been executed after the murder of Sadat, but were implicated in it and been imprisoned. Off they go.
One of the most powerful of these newcomers was Ayman Zawahiri. He was the leader of a radical faction from Egypt called Islamic Jihad. And he was convinced that they, not the moderates, were the true Islamists.
We are here. We are here. The real Islamic Front. We are here. The real Islamic Front and the real Islamic opposition against Zionism. We are here. The real Islamic Front against Zionism, communism and imperialism.
Ayman Zawahiri was a follower of the Egyptian revolutionary Said Qutb, who had been executed in 1966. As last week's program showed, Qutb believed that the liberal ideas in Western societies corrupted the minds of Muslims because they unleashed the most selfish aspects of human nature. Zawahiri had interpreted Qutb's theories to mean that this corruption included the Western system of democracy. Democracy, Zawahiri believed, encouraged politicians to set themselves up as the source of all authority. And by doing this, they were rejecting the higher authority of the Quran. This meant they were no longer true Muslims, and so they and those who supported them could legitimately be killed. The terror this created, he said, would shock the masses into seeing the truth behind the corrupt facade of democracy.
When the Egyptians, the jihadi group, came from Egypt,
Abdullah Anas,
with their own explanation, with their own ideas, that anybody participate in any parliament or any political party or going to elect or call people for the election and sort of these activities is totally rejecting the Quran. So when you say that, it means when a Muslim rejecting the Quran simply must be killed. He should be killed, must be killed. And that's what happened.
Zawahiri and his small group settled in Peshawar. They began to spread this new idea among the foreign fighters, radicalizing the Islamist movement. It was not only a direct challenge to the moderate ideas of Abdullah Azam, but it also involved a militant rejection of all American influence over the jihad, because America was the source of this corruption.
The only times that I ever ran into any real trouble in Afghanistan,
Milton Bearden,
is when I ran into these guys. You know, it would be kind of a moment or two that would look a little bit like the bar scene in Star Wars, you know, where you're just kind of each group kind of jockeying around. And finally, somebody has to sort of defuse the situation.
Then, in 1987, the new Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, decided he was going to withdraw Russian troops from Afghanistan. Gorbachev was convinced that the whole Soviet system was facing collapse. He was determined to try and save it through political reform, and this meant reversing the policies of his predecessors, including the occupation of Afghanistan.
Mikhail Gorbachev.
The state of the Soviet Union and its society could be described very simply with a phrase used by people across the country. We can't go on living like this any longer. That applied to everything. The economy was stagnating, there were shortages, and the quality of goods was very poor. We had to finish this war, but in such a way that the Russian people would understand why tens of thousands had died. We couldn't just run away from there in shame. No. We needed to find a process.
Gorbachev asked the Americans to help him negotiate a peace that would create a stable government in Afghanistan. But the hardliners in Washington refused point blank. They would continue to help the Mujahideen until the last Russians left, without any negotiation. The future of Afghanistan would then be decided, they said, by the freedom fighters.
Vladimir Posner, Soviet spokesman in the United States, interviewed in 1987.
I think that basically we've asked the United States, help us get out, if you're really interested in stopping the bloodshed.
But can you get out and leave a government in Afghanistan that supports, that is a friend of the Soviet Union?
I believe that we can get out, provided that indeed no more aid is given to what people here call freedom fighters and what we call counter-revolutionaries. I believe that's possible, provided that the United States is also interested in the same.
Well, it's not very complicated. They arrived in a matter of days on Christmas Eve in 1979. They could be home by Christmas Eve if they decided to leave Afghanistan and let the Afghans decide their own future. If you leave, the problem of support to the Mujahideen solves itself.
Richard Perle, then Assistant Secretary of Defense.
Gorbachev was shocked by the intransigence of the U.S. administration. He sent a private message through the KGB, warning the Americans that if they allowed the Mujahideen to take control in Afghanistan, it would not produce democracy. Instead, he predicted, the most extreme forms of Islamism would rise up and triumph. But Gorbachev's warning was ignored. As Soviet troops left Afghanistan, both the Americans and the Islamists came to believe that they had not only won the battle for Afghanistan, they had also begun the downfall of the entire evil empire.
Milton Bearden.
I felt we won, because I was part of it. I'm sure that the Afghan Arabs felt we won. And then all summer long, the East Germans began to gather, 100 here, 1,000, tens of thousands, until November 9th, and the wall was opened, and that's it. Start the clock running on the Soviet Union, and it was over. Soviet Union was all cracked up and broken, and that was done.
For the neoconservatives, the collapse of the Soviet Union was a triumph. And out of that triumph was going to come the central myth that still inspires them today, that through the aggressive use of American power, they could transform the world and spread democracy. But in reality, their victory was an illusion. They had conquered a phantom enemy, an exaggerated and distorted fantasy they had created in their own minds. The real reason the Soviet Union collapsed was because it was a decrepit system, decaying from within.
I think probably one of the greatest myths in American political discourse right now, is that actions of the American government were responsible for the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Melvin Goodman. Head of the CIA Office of Soviet Affairs, 1976 through 87.
The Soviet Union collapsed like a house of cards because it was a house of cards. It rotted away from within. The economy was rotten. The political process was rotten. They had developed a central government that was no longer believed by people outside of Moscow. There was total cynicism throughout the Soviet system of governance. There was no real civil society. But the Reagan administration and the minions of the Reagan administration will tell you that Afghanistan led to a collapse of the Soviet Union itself, the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the collapse of the East European Empire. we were saying that this was entirely fanciful, and the United States missed all of this because they believed their own myths and their own fanciful notions. They had become their own victims of their own lies.
And for the Islamists too, a great myth was born out of the struggle in Afghanistan, that it was they who had conquered the Soviet Union. The Islamists believed that this great victory would start a revolution that would sweep across the Arab world and topple the corrupt leaders. But as with the neoconservatives, this dream was built on an illusion.
The Islamists were convinced that they were the key instrument in the demise of the Soviet army in Afghanistan.
Giles Keppel, historian of the Islamist movement.
They just would not like to remember that without U.S. military help and training, they couldn't have done anything, and also that the Afghans were the ones who ousted the Soviets, not the Arab jihadis who didn't really fight. They were trained, but they were not the fighters. But the myth has it that they were the ones who won. I mean, this was jihad that had triumphed. This was something very powerful that was a mobilizing force for Islamists worldwide.
But there was a deep rift within the Islamist fighters based in Peshawar, between the moderates, led by Abdullah Azam, who believed this revolution could be accomplished politically, and the extremists, like Ayman Zawahiri, who saw violent revolution as the only way. And Zawahiri now set out to extend his influence over the movement and to undermine Abdullah Azam. To do this, he seduced Osama bin Laden and his money away from Azam. He promised bin Laden that he could become the emir, the leader of Zawahiri's small extremist group, Islamic Jihad.
Ayman Zawahiri and another group of Egyptians, they refused to pray behind Abdullah Azam in Peshawar.
Abdullah Anas.
They use to create rumors in Peshawar against Abdullah Azam. That's why we became angry about Osama, why he closed these people to him. They accepted him as an emir, and he accepted them as a group. Finally, I don't know who did use the other.
What do you think?
I think the other used him.
Because he had the money?
Yes.
Then, at the end of 1989, Abdullah Azam was assassinated by a huge car bomb in Peshawar. It is still unknown who carried out the assassination. But despite his death, it seemed as if Azam's vision of a political revolution might prevail. In the early 90s, in countries across the Arab world, Islamist parties began to gather mass support. In Algeria, the Islamic Salvation Front won overwhelming victories in local elections and looks certain to win the coming general election. And at the same time in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood began to win mass support and a growing number of seats in parliament. Both parties were riding to power on an idealistic vision. They would use Islam in a political way to create a new type of model society through peaceful means.
Saif Albana, senior member of Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt. We can change people through education and religious conviction. We want to build a popular base. This is the right way to do it. We do not want a military coup. We do not want violence. We want our rights. If people believe in us, the government must comply with the people's wishes.
But the governments in both Egypt and Algeria faced a terrible dilemma. At the heart of the Islamist vision was the idea that the Quran should be used as the political framework for the society, an absolute set of laws beyond debate that all politicians had to follow. The implication of this was that political parties would be irrelevant because there could be no disagreement. The people were about to vote in parties that might use their power to end democracy.
Quel, c'est un dilemme.
Ali Haroun, Algerian Minister for Human Rights, 1991-92. But what a dilemma. Do you find a way of stopping the electoral process and canceling the second round? Or do you let power go to a party which claims one man, one vote, but only once? We won't have any elections after this because democracy is non-religious. Once we're in power, we'll stay there forever because we alone are the keepers of religious truth and we alone shall apply the Quran.
Faced by this dilemma, in Algeria, the army decided to step in. And in June 1991, they staged a coup d'etat and immediately cancelled the elections. Mass protests by the Islamists were repressed violently and their leaders arrested. At the same time in Egypt, the government also clamped down. They arrested hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood members and banned the organization from any political activity.
What happened is a wave of arresting Muslim Brothers, a wave of military court for Muslim Brothers, going to kill some of Muslim Brothers under torture.
Assam Al-Aryan, senior member of the Muslim Brotherhood,
they
Egypt.
Stopped all the free elections in all of the society and institution. And this wave and this manner, you open the doors of hell for the violent groups who were hidden underground, and it stopped the moderates, opens the door for the violence.
For Ayman Zawahiri, this was a dramatic confirmation of his belief that the Western system of democracy was a corrupt sham. Groups of radical Islamists, who had developed his theories in even more extreme forms, now set out to create violent revolutions in Algeria and Egypt. It would be the start of a jihad that would liberate the Muslim world from corruption.
Osama bin Laden. The only way to eradicate the humiliation that has overcome the land of Islam is jihad, bullets, and martyrdom operations.
And Laden and the others started from now on to wage their own jihad, i.e., not to compromise, not to try to compromise with more moderate groups.
Giles Keppel, historian of the Islamist movement.
But thinking that an armed vanguard would be able to implement the seizing of power, they were convinced that they could duplicate the Afghan victory, or quote-unquote victory, that they could establish an Islamist state in Algeria, in Egypt, and the like. They thought that was capture the hearts and minds of the Muslim masses, that people would realize that strength and victory were on the side of the jihadis.
At this same time in Washington, the other group who believed that they had brought down the Soviet Union, the neoconservatives, were also determined to push on with their revolutionary agenda. They were convinced that the Soviet Union was just one of many evil regimes in the world, led by tyrants, that threatened America. Regimes they had to conquer to liberate the world and spread democracy.
We want, down with tyranny.
Michael Ledeen, neoconservative theorist.
We want free countries. We think that America's better off if we live in a world primarily populated with free countries who have to appeal to their own people for the source of their power and to ratify their decisions. And we think that if the whole world were like that, then we would be much more secure, and that typically we are attacked by tyrants. I think it's America's destiny, because I think America's always going to come under attack from tyrants. So I think that our only choice is whether we're going to win or lose, and when we will fight and under what circumstances. But that we're going to have to fight, that's automatic, because they're going to come after us.
One of the most evil of these tyrants, the neoconservatives decided, was Saddam Hussein. In the 1980s, Saddam had been America's close ally. But in 1990, he invaded Kuwait. The neoconservatives now saw him as a key to pursuing the next stage of their transformation of the world. An American-led coalition had been created by President Bush Sr. to liberate Kuwait. But the neoconservatives, like Paul Wolfowitz, who was Under Secretary of Defense, wanted to push on to Baghdad and bring about a transformation of the Middle East. It would fulfill America's unique role to defeat evil in the world.
Professor Stephen Holmes.
You see already in 91 the hopes of Wolfowitz and others that the battle against Saddam Hussein or other petty tyrants could take the place of the battle against the Soviet Union and could bear this interpretation of a battle between good and evil. So what you're seeing is the attempt to keep alive the idea that America is engaged in a battle of pure good against pure evil, and to preserve that framework for a world after the end of the Soviet Union.
But President Reagan was no longer in charge. The neoconservatives now had a leader who did not share their vision.
Kuwait is liberated. Iraq's army is defeated. Our military objectives are met.
I am pleased to announce all United States and coalition forces will suspend combat operations.
Once Kuwait was freed, Bush ordered the fighting to stop. His view was that America's role was to create stability in the world, not to try and change it. Like Henry Kissinger, who had been the enemy of the neoconservatives in the 1970s, Bush saw questions of good and evil as irrelevant. The higher aim was to achieve a stable balance of power in the Middle East.
Saddam Hussein is not a threat to his neighbors.
Brent Scowcroft, National Security Advisor to President George Bush Sr., interviewed in 1996.
He's a nuisance. He's an annoyance. But he's not a threat. That we achieved. It was never our objective to get Saddam Hussein. Indeed, had we tried, we still might be occupying Baghdad. That would have turned a great success into a very messy, probable defeat.
In private, the neoconservatives, like Paul Wolfowitz, were furious. Not just because Saddam Hussein had been left in power, but because they saw this as a clear expression of the corrupt liberal values that dominated America. A moral relativism that was prepared to compromise with the forces of evil in the world.
Professor Stephen Holmes.
Wolfowitz's anger is fundamentally an anger against the weakness of American liberalism, the compromising nature of a man like George Bush Sr., his willingness to make concessions, to negotiate, not to drive to the bitter end. And his anger is motivated, interestingly, less by hatred of Saddam Hussein than by hatred of American liberals, who are a source of weakness and a source of rot and a source of relativism that have been corroding American society for decades.
Faced by this defeat, the neoconservative movement now turned inwards to try and defeat the forces of liberalism that were holding it back. And to do this, they turned again to the theories of Leo Strauss. Strauss believed that good politicians should reassert the absolute moral values that would unite society, and this would overcome the moral relativism that liberalism created. One of the most influential Straussians was the new assistant to the vice president, William Crystal.
For Strauss, liberalism had produced a decent way of life and one that he thought was worth defending, but a dead end of where nothing could be said to be true. One had no guidance on how to live. Everything was relative. Strauss suggested that maybe that we didn't just have to sit there and accept that that was our fate, that politics could help shape the way people live, teach them some good lessons about living decent and noble human lives. And can we think about what cultures and what politics, what social orders produce more admirable human beings? I mean, that whole question was put back on the table by Strauss, I think.
The neoconservatives set out to reform America. And at the heart of their project was the political use of religion. Together with their long-term allies, the religious right, they began a campaign to bring moral and religious issues back into the center of conservative politics. It became known as the Culture Wars.
Your tax dollars are being used to sponsor obscene and pornographic displays.
I don't like Jesus Christ, who is my Lord and Savior, being dunked in a vat of urine by a homosexual and then have my money to pay for it. I think that's obscene.
Satan, be gone! Out from this moment on!
For the religious right, this campaign was a genuine attempt to renew the religious basis of American society. But for the neoconservatives, religion was a myth, like the myth of America as a unique nation that they had promoted in the Cold War. Strauss had taught that these myths were necessary to give ordinary people meaning and purpose, and so ensure a stable society.
That they're playing too much Nintendo?
Oh, not anymore. See, Matt has Bible adventures. They're actually learning Bible stories while they're playing Nintendo.
For the neoconservatives, religion is an instrument of promoting morality.
Michael Lynn, journalist and former neoconservative.
Religion becomes what Plato called a noble lie. It is a myth which is told to the majority of the society by the philosophical elite. In order to ensure social order.
What better way to enjoy God's creation than a praise walk? Integrity Music Fitness.
In being a kind of secretive elitist approach, Straussianism does resemble Marxism. These ex-Marxist, or in some cases ex-liberal Straussians, could see themselves as a kind of Leninist group, who have this covert vision, which they want to use to effect change in history. While concealing parts of it from people incapable of understanding it.
Out of this campaign, a new and powerful moral agenda began to take over the Republican Party. It reached a dramatic climax at the Republican Convention in 1992, when the religious right seized control of the party's policy-making machinery. George Bush became committed to run for president with policies that would ban abortion, gay rights, and multiculturalism. Speakers who tried to promote the traditional conservative values of individual freedom were booed off the stage.
I happen to think that individual freedom should extend to a woman's right to choose.
William Well, Republican governor of Massachusetts.
I want the government out of your pocketbook and your bedroom.
For the neoconservatives, the aim of this new morality was to unite the nation. But in fact, it had completely the opposite effect. Mainstream Republican voters were frightened away by the harsh moralism that had taken over their party. They turned instead to Bill Clinton, a politician who connected with their real concerns and needs, like tax and the state of the economy.
Diane Blair, Clinton campaign.
In the week after the Republican convention, Republican moderates, young people, and particularly women, saying, I've been sort of torn between the two parties, but where do I sign up to help Clinton get elected? I am frightened by this ultra-conservative agenda I hear coming out of Houston.
I've been a lifelong Republican. I am a registered Republican. I am voting for Bill Clinton this time. Enough is enough. It is time for a change.
At the end of 1992, Bill Clinton won a dramatic victory. But the neoconservatives were determined to regain power. And to do this, they were going to do to Bill Clinton what they had done to the Soviet Union. They would transform the President of the United States into a fantasy enemy, an image of evil that would make people realize the truth of the liberal corruption of America. In the early 90s, Algeria, Egypt, and other Arab countries were being torn apart by a horrific wave of Islamist terror. The jihadists who had returned from Afghanistan were trying to topple the regimes. At the heart of their strategy was the idea that Ayman Zawahiri and others had taught them, that those who were involved in politics could legitimately be killed because they had become corrupted and were thus no longer Muslims. This violence, they believed, would shock people into rising up and the corrupt regimes would then be overthrown.
They must die. Not only must die, they did kill.
Abdullah Anas, member of the Political Council Islamic Salvation Front, Algeria, 1993.
They did kill people. Not just, yani, it's not just an idea from far. It became true. People killed. Many, many rulers, many, many ulama, many, many scholars, many, many politicians in Islamic world have been killed because of these ideas. Why? Because simply they are against the Quran. They rejected the Quran. Why they rejected the Quran? Because they did elect.
Ayman Zawahiri was now based with bin Laden in this farm in the Sudan. He used it as a base for his group Islamic Jihad to launch attacks on politicians in Egypt. But as one of the leading ideologues of the revolution, he also traveled throughout the Arab world, advising other groups on their strategy. But the revolutionaries soon found that the masses did not rise up and follow them. The regimes stayed in power, and the radical Islamists were hunted down. Faced by this, the Islamists widened their terror. Their logic was brutal. It was not just those who were involved with politics who should be killed, but the ordinary people who supported it. Their refusal to rise up showed that they too had become corrupted, and so had condemned themselves to death.
There was definitely a logic.
Dr. Azam Tamimi, Institute of Islamic Political Thought.
The logic is that you assault the leaders, you assault those who are associated with them, and eventually you assault the people who have consented to the presence of such a despotic leader, even if they are passively supportive through their silence. And then you start attacking economic institutions, you start attacking the tourists, because the tourists bring money to the country, and that money goes into the pockets of the corrupt elite. So it is an endless process.
In Algeria, this logic went completely out of control. The Islamist revolutionary groups killed thousands of civilians because they believed that all these people had become corrupted.
Algerian survival. All these innocents, what did they do? Legs blown off. Such horror. Even the French extremists never did things like this. Why? What have we done? What have our children done? Leave me alone. I want to die.
In turn, the generals running Algeria infiltrated the revolutionary groups. They told their agents to persuade the Islamists to push the logic even further, to kill even more people. This would create such horror that the groups would lose any remaining support, and the generals could use the fear and revulsion to increase their grip on power.
Abdullah Anas.
The generals infiltrated the jihad ideas, the jihad groups, to put the society under fear by creating terror and violence. Everything in the society, no politic, no economic, no everything, just to stay and saying to the West, we are facing terror.
Using fear.
Using fear to stay on the power.
Algerian soldiers. Today they kill. They kill everybody. Innocent people, children, old people. They have even cut up their victims. Who will trust them if tomorrow they take power?
By 1997, the Islamist revolution was failing. There were mass demonstrations against the Islamist groups by thousands of people horrified by the violence. And then, in June of that year, a group of Egyptian Islamists attacked Western tourists at the ruins of Luxor. 58 were killed in 3 hours of random violence. The massacre shocked the Egyptian people, and the leaders of the revolutionary groups agreed to call a ceasefire. In Algeria, a few groups held out, but they began to tear each other apart as they followed the logic that had driven their revolution to its ultimate and logical end. They started to kill each other.
Dr. Azam Tamimi.
It led to their own destruction. A group that believes in a 100% pure Muslim will not see that purity in anybody else but themselves. So whoever disagrees with them becomes the enemy, becomes out of the house of Islam. And then if they happen to disagree with each other themselves, then they will start liquidating each other. And they keep fighting each other. They will be in fighting. Eventually it ends in suicide.
The main Islamist group in Algeria, the GIA, ended by being led by a Mr. Zouabri, a chicken farmer, who killed everyone who disagreed with him. He issued a final communique declaring that the whole of Algerian society should be killed, with the exception of his tiny remaining band of Islamists. They were the only ones who understood the truth. By the mid-90s, politics in Washington was dominated by one issue, the moral character of the President of the United States.
If you believe you've been a victim of sexual harassment by the President, we want to help.
Behind this were an extraordinary barrage of allegations against Clinton that were obsessing the media. These included stories of sexual harassment, stories that Clinton and his wife were involved in Whitewater, a corrupt property deal, stories that they had murdered their close friend, Vince Foster, and stories that Clinton was involved in smuggling drugs from a small airstrip in Arkansas. But none of these stories were true. All of them had been orchestrated by a young group of neoconservatives who were determined to destroy Clinton. The campaign was centered on a small right-wing magazine called The American Spectator, which had set up what was called the Arkansas Project to investigate Clinton's past life. The journalist at the center of this project was called David Brock.
Tonight, the Arkansas allegations in the crossfire. David Brock of the American Spectator magazine.
She was dressed in a raincoat and a hat and came in at 5:15 in the morning and had a liaison with Clinton in the game room
in the bottom floor of the governor's mansion. This is getting a little bizarre. Next thing we're going to see
Bill Clinton is a bizarre guy.
Wait a second.
Since then, Brock has turned against the neoconservative movement. He now believes that the attacks on Clinton went too far and corrupted conservative politics.
Was Whitewater true?
David Brock.
No, there was no, I mean, there was no criminal wrongdoing in Whitewater, absolutely not. It was a land deal that the Clintons lost money on. It was a complete inversion of what happened.
Was Vince Foster killed?
No. Killed himself.
Did the Clintons smuggle drugs?
Absolutely not.
Did those promoting these stories know that this was not true, that none of these stories were true?
They did not care.
Why not?
Because they were having a devastating effect. So why stop? It was terrorism, political terrorism.
And you were part one of the agents.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The stories began to grip America. And despite Clinton's denials, the Republicans in Congress seized on the scandals and began to press for investigations into this immorality the heart of government.
Basically, the press has editorialized and pressured the politicians into saying, here's a guy that, as far as we know, hadn't done anything wrong. Nobody's ever accused him of doing anything wrong. There's no evidence that he's done anything wrong, but we think the presumption of guilt almost should be on him. He should somehow prove his innocence.
Out of this pressure, Clinton was forced to agree to an independent investigation into Whitewater. It was headed by a senior judge in Washington called Kenneth Starr. But what was not widely known was that Starr was a member of a right-wing group of lawyers called the Federalist Society that had financial and ideological links to the neoconservatives. And like the neoconservatives, they saw Clinton as a danger to the country. And they were determined to prove this to the American people.
In the Merck Manual, which is, Merck is a pharmaceutical company,
They have a manual listing various disorders.
Judge Robert Bork, senior member, Federalist Society.
And they listed sociopath. And if you look at sociopath, it tracks Clinton exactly. Somebody who's charming, who has no particular feeling at all for the people he's charming, unable to resist instant gratification, and so on and so on. You're right on the list. We had a very dysfunctional man in the presidency that was very dangerous, both as a model and as if crisis had arisen, I had no confidence that he would meet it.
But despite all his efforts, Kenneth Starr could find no incriminating evidence in Whitewater. Nor could he find any evidence to support any of the sexual scandals that had come from the Arkansas Project. Until finally, his committee stumbled upon Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky, which Clinton denied. And in that lie, the neoconservative movement believed they had found what they had been looking for, a way to make the American people see the truth about the liberal corruption of their country. A campaign now began to impeach the president. And in the hysteria, the whole conservative movement portrayed Clinton as a depraved monster who had to be removed from office.
Everybody hold. Let's go.
But yet again, the neoconservatives had created a fantasy enemy by exaggerating and distorting reality.
Joe Connison, author of The Hunting of the President.
They were trapped by a mythological person that they constructed, or persons, the Clintons, these scheming, terrible people who they, the noble pursuers, were going to vanquish. I think in the leadership of conservatism, during the Clinton era, there was an element of corruption. There was an element of a willingness to do anything to achieve the goal of bringing Clinton down. There was a way in which the people who perceived Clinton as immoral behaved immorally themselves. They ended up behaving worse than the people who they were attacking.
All the moral fury and the deception came to nothing. The impeachment failed because the polls consistently showed that Americans still did not care about these moral issues. One leading neoconservative, William Bennett, wrote a book called The Death of Outrage, which blamed the people. He accused the public of making a deal with the devil. Their failure, he said, to support the impeachment was evidence of their moral corruption. By 1997, Bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri had returned to Afghanistan, where they had first met 10 years before. Back then, it had seemed as if Islamism might succeed as a popular revolutionary movement. But now they were facing failure. All attempts to topple regimes in the Arab world had not succeeded. The people had turned against them because of the horrific violence. And Afghanistan was the only place they had left to go.
Well, 1997 was their failure. Egypt, Algeria, it worked nowhere.
Giles Keppel, historian of the Islamist movement.
It went wrong because populations would not back them, because people, even people who were sympathetic to them in the beginning, were frightened away by their violence, by their incapacity to communicate and to have access to the people. And this is very clear in Zawahiri's book, Knights Under the Prophet's Banner, where he sort of goes back on this experiment and laments over their incapacity to rise the consciousness of the masses, and feels that, you know, as a vanguard, they did not manage to communicate. They remained isolated, and this is why they failed. And this is when they started this new strategy.
In May 1998, Bin Laden and Zawahiri invited a group of journalists to this press conference, where they announced a new jihad. Zawahiri was convinced that it was not their theories that were to blame for the failure. It was the fault of the Muslim masses. Their minds had been corrupted by the liberal ideas from the West. But rather than give up, he believed that the solution was to attack the source of the corruption directly. The new jihad would be against America itself.
He says, as I mentioned before, We focus our efforts to fight against Jews and Christians or Americans. We have no objection against any party or any person who fights Americans all over the world. And we want to tell you that we will win the war against Americans. America will be defeated. Americans know our power.
This was a strategy of desperation, born out of failure by a small group whose revolution had failed. And the anger that came from that failure was about to be directed at the United States. What Zawahiri and bin Laden were about to do would dramatically affect the future of the neoconservative movement. By 1998, all their attempts to transform America by creating a moral revolution had failed. Faced with the indifference of the people, the neoconservatives had become marginalized in both domestic and foreign policy. But with the attacks that were about to hit America, the neoconservatives would at last find the evil enemy that they had been searching for ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in their reaction to the attacks, the neoconservatives would transform the failing Islamist movement into what would appear to be the grand revolutionary force that Zawahiri had always dreamed of. But much of it would exist only in people's imaginations. It would be the next phantom enemy.
You've been listening to The Power of Nightmares, The Rise of the Politics of Fear, part two of a three-part documentary by the British filmmaker Adam Curtis, adapted for radio. We'll conclude with part three next week. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. Dennis Bernstein is one of the finest investigative journalists in radio. His daily program, Flashpoints, is heard on community radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. Last week, he spoke with David Ray Griffin on his new book that uncovers the 9/11.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. We are delighted to welcome back to these airwaves David Ray Griffin. You might remember his book, The New Pearl Harbor, which was a terrific work in raising key questions about the lack of real investigation and a thorough look at what happened before, during, and after the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers. Well, he's back. He's got a new book. The book is called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and that's exactly what we want to talk about, omissions and distortions. Well, it's good to have you, and I guess as a way of overview, why don't you tell us why you titled your book as you did?
Well, I expected it to be bad. I expected it to be a whitewash, but as I say in the introduction, I was really shocked by just the sheer number of omissions and the audacity of the distortions in this report. And the overall message of this book is that the impact it had on me, that any doubt I had after writing the earlier book that the administration was involved was overcome by this, because if the 9/11 Commission had to resort to such omissions and distortions, in other words, lies, dozens and dozens of lies, then they had to be covering up crimes in the highest places.
All right, let's just talk about the book. Give us more of an overview and talk a little bit about the methodology you used.
Well, the day after the 9/11 Commission report came out, I got a copy and I started reading it. And as I say, I was immediately shocked. On the very first page, for example, one of the things I had discussed in the earlier book, The New Pearl Harbor, was the fact that several of the hijackers, at least six of them, the alleged hijackers, have been shown to be still alive. And this is now well known in the 9/11 community, and it was in my book, and many, many copies of my book were given to the 9/11 Commission. So they surely know this. Nevertheless, on the very first page of the 9/11 Commission report, they cite these hijackers, all 19 of them, the same original names. Even in the middle of the book, they give photographs. They go into great detail about these hijackers' families, and not a single mention of the fact that at least six of them have shown up alive. So my method was simply to read the book in the light of my previous book, in which I had summarized the results of the researches of other people to show that there were dozens and dozens of questions to ask about the official story about 9/11. And so I read the report to see how it handled them, I found out that the rest of the book was just like this first chapter with the hijackers. That is, it handled all the questions by simply ignoring them, or in a few cases where they evidently thought they could make a point and make a rebuttal, they do that, but only by distorting the facts.
All right. And before we jump into that discussion about the hijackers and talk a little bit more about it, talk about the makeup of the committee and the investigative structure and why that in itself, in other words, the people who put the investigation together and supervised it, are not trustworthy or need to be questioned or conflicted, if you will.
Yes. Well, the subtitle of my book is A Critique of the Cain-Zelikow Report. Quite often we refer to commissions like this by the name of the chairman. So many people call this the Cain Commission, after Thomas Cain, the chairman. But much more important than Cain, actually, was the executive director, and this was Philip Zelikow. As executive director, he was in charge of the staff. And this got very little attention in the press, but it's crucial because it's the staff that did all the work. These commissioners we saw on TV, they just showed up and dealt with the reports that the staff had worked out. And so in some cases probably didn't even know about the omissions that the staff had perpetrated and their distortions. But in any case, Zelikow, why this is important, is he's virtually a member of the Bush White House. He was a member of the first Bush White House, where he got to know Condoleezza Rice, and they became such close colleagues that they wrote a book together while the Republicans were out of office. Then she brought him in to help her with the transition after she was appointed National Security Advisor for the Bush II White House. And then he was also appointed to the Foreign Policy Board by George Bush the second. And so if we think of the 9/11 report as a report about how did the White House handle 9/11, which is the crucial question, you essentially had the White House investigating itself. We would not have tolerated it if we had said, well, let's make Dick Cheney or Condoleezza Rice put them in charge of the 9/11 Commission. But Philip Zelikow is just as bad, and yet that's exactly what it is. And also in the conclusion of the book, I report that Peter Lanz, in his recent and very important book called Cover Up, reports that he had a friend, a confidant, inside the 9/11 Commission staff, and this staff person said that Zelikow totally directed the staff, and of the, I believe, nine committees there were who were to deal with the various topics, that Zelikow completely controlled all but one of them.
That's the voice of David Ray Griffin, and his new book is the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and there were many, that's for sure. Now let's come back to your chapter about the alleged hijackers. And as you pointed out in describing how you put the book together, there was the sense that one gets or the public has is that the hijackers are all dead. So you're saying they're alive. And what's the significance of the fact that they're still alive?
What we have, and the way I set up the book, is the question of we've got two conspiracy theories. Now, you know, people say they reject conspiracy theories, but the official story about 9/11 is the original conspiracy theory, that 9/11 was brought about by a conspiracy among Muslims directed by Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. And these 19 devout Muslims were the ones who brought off the hijacking. And it's important that they were devout Muslims because they were, you know, obviously ready to meet their maker. And so death was no problem for them. But now we learn that at least six of them were not on the planes because they're still alive. Then we learn also that Muhammad Atta, who is supposed to be the ringleader, far from being a devout Muslim, and the 9/11 Commission report says he had become a fanatical Muslim, this guy notoriously enjoyed lap dances, alcohol, ate pork, which Muslims can't do, gambled, lived with a prostitute. So we don't know the truth about him. Hani Hanjour was supposed to be the pilot of the plane that hit the Pentagon, and it had to make this incredibly difficult downward spiral, which many pilots say they're not sure they could pull off in a 757, and yet he was known as a horrible pilot. And so we have severe questions about at least eight of the hijackers, and we don't know that any of the 19 hijackers that have been named and were dealt with at such great length in the 9/11 Commission report were actually on the plane. Maybe all 19 of them were made up. Maybe there were no hijackers. We just don't know. And the 9/11 Commission report shed no light whatsoever on this. It just repeated the official story.
Well, we have information based on Seymour Hersh's investigation of the way in which the Bush administration has carried out extra-legal kidnapping operations. They've got the CIA. They've got special squads where they go all over the world. They kidnap people. They bring them to torture centers in Syria. And they, if you will, debrief them. You would think if the CIA is willing to have a secret plan to go around the world kidnapping people, if these hijackers were still alive, why wouldn't they go after them?
That's a very good question.
Okay. That's just one more good question. Let's just focus for a moment, speaking in terms of the Saudi situation.
Let me respond to that.
Yes.
I mean, in case listeners didn't get the point, I mean, the point is that what we've been told about Osama bin Laden does not jive with many facts, both before 9/11. We have it on very good authority that a CIA agent visited Osama bin Laden in July of 2001. In other words, very shortly before 9/11. We also have numerous reports suggesting that when we were supposedly trying to get him dead or alive in Afghanistan, that repeatedly the U.S. military let him go in the final assault there on the Tora Bora, that they blocked only one of the two roads leading to Pakistan and just let him go. So that's the serious point here, is that maybe all of them were, whoever was involved, if there were some hijackers on there, that they were agents of the U.S. government, or who knows. So it's so complex that I don't try to get into the questions of what really happened, but simply point out that the official story doesn't make any sense.
Now, talk a little bit about the issue that Michael Moore raises in Fahrenheit 9/11. You've got a chapter that deals with the Saudi flights. Remind people what Moore was saying and what you're saying about these flights that apparently took a whole bunch of Saudis out of the country before the airspace over the U.S. was shut down right after 9/11.
There are two dimensions to this story. One is that on September 13th, 2 days after 9/11, while American airspace had not been reopened, that some Saudi private flights were allowed, and presumably that could only happen with White House authorization. The second part of the story is that that some flights went out of the country, not necessarily before then, although there seemed to be a couple that did, but that mainly they were not interrogated. And some of the people who allegedly, we learned later, had prior knowledge of 9/11 were on those flights. And then there was Osama bin Laden's own brother who was on one of those flights and where they were not interrogated. But let me go back to the September 13th, because Michael Moore was roundly ridiculed in the press, and then many press people used the 9/11 report to show that, to argue that Michael Moore was all wet, because the 9/11 Commission showed that there was no ban on flights on the 13th. And here it looks like deliberate distortion, because it was very clear, and Unger had made very clear, that at 11 o'clock that morning, they allowed commercial flights to start going, but put out a special notice saying, be very clear, this is only for commercial flights. Any private flights will be forced down. And yet this private flight went from Lexington to, from Tampa to Lexington at 4 o'clock that afternoon. And so Michael Moore and Craig Unger were absolutely right that this was in violation of the shutdown, and that therefore it's most likely that there was White House authorization.
All right, let's come back to Osama bin Laden. That's perhaps the longest chapter in the book. We have heard that Osama was disinherited by his own family, the royal family, and we want to understand more about what you think in terms of his role and the bin Laden family. There's been a lot of discussion about the relationship between the bin Laden family and the Bush family. Not everybody thinks that's as important as some of the other things. So talk about Osama bin Laden in this context.
Well, the historical point, which one can read in great detail in Craig Unger's book, House of Bush, House of Saud, is that the Bushes and the bin Ladens go way back, and they've been involved in multi-million dollar business deals for a very long time. And some of them appear to be quite shady. With that background, the question must be raised, given these reports that I've just given about the apparent discrepancy between what the White House was saying about going after bin Laden and then the actual behavior, of whether we were really going after bin Laden or we're deliberately letting him go, which would make sense if he had actually been an agent, that is, if he had been an agent of the CIA, as he had been back during the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Some people think that link between Osama bin Laden and the CIA was never broken, just as they think that the story that he became a black sheep and was disowned by his family is false, because they've shown up at weddings together. And just as the idea that he was persona non grata in Saudi Arabia and that they were totally opposed to him is suggested to be false by the fact that when he was in this hospital in Dubai, when the U.S. CIA agent apparently visited him, so did the head of Saudi intelligence. So the whole question is the relationship one that is almost the opposite of the picture that has been portrayed? And the 9/11 Commission did not even raise a single one of these questions. That's one of the gross omissions.
It is interesting that somebody like James Baker III, the former Secretary of State and the close associate of the Bush family, the man who, for instance, the Bushes called down in 2000 to, some believe, steal or help steal the 2000 election. James Baker is, in fact, the attorney for the Saudis representing the Saudis in a certain context against the families of 9/11.
Yes, and so that's just one more illustration of this very cozy relationship that has existed for a long time, and particularly with the Bush administrations. And so another chapter in the book deals with this whole question of the relationship between the U.S. government, the Saudi government, and Al-Qaeda. And I show that very reputable sources, including the chairman, one of the co-chairmen of the joint inquiry, have suggested that they found out that there had actually been direct Saudi government financing of Al-Qaeda. The 9/11 Commission report repeats its little mantra, we have found no evidence that there has been any funding from any foreign government, and they say that specifically about Saudi Arabia, contradicting the very report that the 9/11 report was supposed to start with, that is the joint inquiry's final report was given to the 9/11 Commission as their starting point. And so one of the many facts they omit is that that commission, the joint inquiry's report, had said there definitely was Saudi financing.
That's David Ray Griffin. His new book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, is just out. And we wanted to do a thorough interview about the investigation and what many believe was a cover-up. Let me direct you now to the FBI obstructions. Among the interesting people that didn't really make it very much into the 9/11 Commission, almost not at all, was Sybil Edmonds. She was a translator for the FBI. Talk about her and talk about what you see as the obstructionist role played by the FBI.
Yes, for listeners who don't know, Sybil Edmonds was hired after 9/11 as a translator. She quickly discovered that one of her co-translators, who had also been hired, was still working for one of the organizations that she was supposed to be investigating and supposed to be translating. And Sybil found out that either she was not translating these documents or she was translating them inaccurately. And furthermore, this woman approached her then and said that she was a spy for this organization, and would Sybil Edmonds join her? And so naturally, Sybil went to her superiors and told them about it, and they told her to shut up. And so
who was the person and what was the organization?
She does not reveal the organization, but the woman's name was Melikan Dickerson. It's in both of my books, so people can get the details. And so then she went to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department slapped a gag order on her so that she's not allowed to talk in public about details of this. She's been trying ever since then to get this opened up, and she thought one route might be the 9/11 Commission. So she volunteered to tell her story to them. She says that she testified for 3.5 hours. She, in a later letter, has laid out 8 major points that she made to the commission, some of them, well, actually all of them, absolutely damning points about corruption within the FBI and cover-ups. For example, that an Iranian asset had given them information about the attacks, about Osama, prior to 9/11, and they were just told to shut up and keep quiet about it. And so she told them all this. And the upshot of her 3.5 hours of testimony was one tiny note in the back of the book, among, you know, many pages of notes in very fine print, in which it says that she was one of 4 people who suggested the FBI should make sure it follows its own procedures. So very relatively innocuous suggestion. If you compare that with the 8 points, and I repeat 5 of them in my book, you see that this is another gross cover-up. And back to the problem then of the commission, it was not just Velikow, but people may think when they hear about the staff that these were bright-eyed college students or people just out of college who were eager to get the truth about 9/11. No, these were, at least half of them, were former members of the very organizations they were supposed to be investigating. So you had several members who were former FBI members, and so you know that they have friends who are still in the FBI. They have loyalty to the FBI. You had many, many members who are former members of the Justice Department, CIA, immigration. So you had those entities essentially investigating themselves. And this is why people ask, why are no names named? Well, they were not going to name the names of themselves. In some cases, they were actually investigating events that happened under their own watches.
All right, now I want to come back to Sybelle Edmonds, the translator who volunteered, who gave, she says, 3.5 hours of testimony. I asked you before, she was concerned that she was working with another translator who was not translating documents that had to do with an organization they were investigating regarding 9/11. Why can't we know the name of that organization? Why won't she tell us?
I think that is part of the gag order, that she's actually not even allowed to say what languages she was translating. So it's a Justice Department gag order that puts severe restrictions on what she can say. And so she's been trying now for almost 3 years to get that lifted. And I tell the case in the second edition of my New Pearl Harbor. I bring the reader up to date on that, because in the first edition I had one or two paragraphs about her, and then the story had grown so much, and it had become, it's something that's been reported quite regularly in the New York Times and so on. So you know that the 9/11 commissioners had to know about it. And yet they give no space to it whatsoever.
All right, David Ray Griffin, let's turn our attention to the actual actions, the striking of the buildings. In your second chapter, you talk about the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings. Talk a little bit about what you see is crucial in terms of what we know or how we may have been misled about what happened in terms of the collapse of the towers. And Building 7, I guess.
Yes, and let me start with Building Number 7, because it has always been considered the most mysterious of the collapses, because obviously no plane hit it, so you can't say that it was weakened by the impact. So it had no fuel oil in it, so you can't say that it was the jet fuel that caused this fire and so on. And FEMA, which was given the task of coming up with an explanation, essentially said it couldn't give an explanation. It gave a very fantastic scenario, which how it might have happened, and it itself said the best explanation we can give has a very low probability of occurrence. So, well, how did the 9/11 Commission tackle this? It simply omitted any mention of Building 7 whatsoever. So one of the biggest mysteries of the 21st century, why did this giant skyscraper fall down, which is particularly mysterious in that it only had relatively small fires on two of its 47 floors. So the idea that these small fires could have brought down this giant skyscraper and in about 12 seconds, just like a controlled demolition, is of course absurd. With regard to the towers,
and why is that? I mean, and so, what are we suggesting, that there was some kind of explosives planted, that it was internal inside?
Well, that's one of the questions I point out that they don't discuss, is the fact that Building Number 7 and the towers had 10 characteristics that are standard characteristics of controlled demolitions, and that's where you plant explosives throughout the building and very precise places to break the steel. And also you put it on a computer so that it comes down in a certain order, and that's why these are controlled, so they fall directly straight down into their footprints, because if these 110-story buildings, which the Twin Towers were, had fallen sideways, they would have caused devastation throughout, you know, much of Manhattan. And so it's very important that they come straight down. And so they have all the features. That is, they do fall straight down. They fall down at virtually free fall speed. One of the, and I say eight other characteristics, such as the molten steel, such as the seismic vibrations and so on at the time that the explosives would have gone off in the sub-basements. But another feature that is very important about the Twin Towers is that these towers, their most distinctive feature was that their core consisted of 47 massive steel columns, which went from the sub-basements to the 110th floor. Now, the official theory of those who accept the official story is that the fire somehow caused the floors to pancake. That is, one floor fell, and then it fell on the floor below it and broke it loose, and then all those floors fell on the floors below those and pancaked all the way down. Well, first of all, the idea that they could pancake at freefall speed virtually is incredible. But another incredible thing is that if you're old enough to know about the old phonographs that had a spindle sticking up in the middle of the records, sometimes the records did pancake. They would all fall down, but the spindle would still stick up into the air. Well, likewise, if these floors had pancaked, you would have had those steel columns sticking hundreds of feet up into the air. But as we all know, we've seen the pictures, the collapse was total, and the rubble is no more than three stories high. So how did those massive steel columns all fall down? How does the 9/11 Commission report handles that? It just denies that there were any columns. It says that the core of each building consisted of a hollow steel shaft in which were the elevators and the stairwells. And the truth was, it consisted of these 47 massive steel columns, in between which were the elevators and the stairwells. So a massive, so either I said there, the commission had to be terribly ignorant, or they had to be telling an enormous lie.
Now, what about, let's focus on the Pentagon. What about the strike on the Pentagon do you find questionable?
Well, again, that the 9/11 Commission did not deal with any of the questions that have been raised publicly, and they know they have been raised. One of the questions is, the one I mentioned earlier, how could Afhani Hanjour, a horrible pilot, pulled off this amazing acrobatic trick, and so that he brought this giant 757 in at treetop level. They lie and they say it dove into the Pentagon. Well, if it dove into the Pentagon, it would have hit the roof. But no, it came down and hit the bottom floor, the bottom two floors. So it was coming along at ground level at several hundred miles an hour. No terrible amateur pilot could have done anything remotely like that. So that's one issue. Another issue is, why would the terrorist have struck the West Wing? All the top brass and Rumsfeld were in the East Wing. If these terrorists were these geniuses that they're portrayed to be that could pull off this attack and, fool all of our defenses, they surely would have known which part of the Pentagon to hit to really inflict damage. And yet they chose the worst part. That is, the West Wing was being renovated. No top brass there, and in fact, most of the people in there were civilians who were working on the renovation. So it actually killed more civilians than it did military people or even Pentagon employees. A third question is, they ignore the fact that there are photos, one taken by a Marine, which shows that a half hour after this giant airplane allegedly hit the facade of the West Wing, the facade is still standing, and there's simply a small hole in it, and it didn't collapse for about a half hour. How is that conceivable if it had just been hit by a Boeing 757? And furthermore, where is the Boeing in all the pictures that we've seen? It's not outside. Anybody can see that on any of these websites that I refer the reader to. And the people who went inside, like the fire chief, said it wasn't in there. They didn't see any Boeing airplane parts, any big thing, fuselage, engines, or anything. So there's question after question after question about the official story that the Pentagon was hit by Flight 77, which was a 757. The 9/11 report handles all these questions by simply ignoring
them. Wait a minute. The 757 that hit the Pentagon, there are no artifacts?
There are some artifacts of airplane in the Pentagon, but they seem to be much smaller than artifacts from a 757.
And what would be the significance of a different plane?
Well, that it was not Flight 77 that hit the Pentagon, and so they've told a massive lie.
My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with David Ray Griffin. He was formerly the author of The New Pearl Harbor. He's got a follow-up book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and we are spending this hour speaking with him about his new book. In the second part of your book, titled The Commission's Defense of the U.S. Military, you claim that instead of really trying to find out how the military failed and why they, if you will, stood down, Commission attempts just to protect them, cover up, and not investigate. Could you talk about that and what you mean by a stand down or stood down?
Since 9/11, critics have been alleging that these attacks simply could not have succeeded given standard operating procedures by which the FAA, if there is any sign that a plane has been hijacked, immediately, within a minute, notifies the military, and then the military sends up normally two jet fighters from the nearest base that has jet fighters on alert, and they go up and intercept the flight and see what's wrong and actually give it instructions saying, follow me, and then if they don't, they give a fire warning shot and so on. That would be normal protocol. The main point here is that normally these interceptions would occur within 10 to 15 minutes after the first signs of hijacking. And yet on 9/11, these flights went 20, 30, or even 40 minutes without any planes being sent to intercept them. And so all along, the critics have been saying, therefore, the military must have had a stand down, that is, momentary cancellation of standard operating procedures. So the question is, how was the 9/11 Commission going to defend the military against this charge? Well, they did it by creating a new story that contradicted everything the military had been saying before. And in fact, the military had previously contradicted itself, so this was the third version. The first official story, which the military was telling the first two or three days, was that they didn't send up any fighters until after the Pentagon was hit. In other words, until after about an hour and a half after things were clearly going wrong. But that evidently appeared too clearly to be a stand down. Some news reporters were saying, well, why weren't jets sent up? And so within a week, and actually CBS News within two or three days was giving out the new story, which is, oh, yes, we did send up planes, but they didn't get there in time. Well, critics looked at the new story, which was published on September 18th, 2001, which was put out by NORAD, and saw the times at which the military said the FAA told them, and then the times at which they ordered the planes to be scrambled, and then the fact that the planes didn't get there, they would still be 70 miles away or whatever. And the critics looked at that and figured out how fast these planes can go. F-15s can actually go over 1,800 miles an hour, so they can cover a lot of miles in 10 minutes, and said, look, even with your timeline, even if we believe this new story, it doesn't add up. The flight should have got there in time, certainly to stop the second crash on the World Trade Center, probably even the first one. And furthermore, definitely the strike on the Pentagon, because you had a lot of time. And so the 9/11 Commission handles this problem by creating a brand new timeline in which they make the FAA look even worse than the previous story had. The FAA in the second version was already terribly irresponsible by, instead of notifying the military within 2 or 3 minutes, you know, waited 20 or so minutes. All those people should have been fired, maybe prosecuted, but nothing happened. Well, the news story makes it even worse that they never notify them. They say that the first flight, they got some notification about 9 minutes, I think, notification on the first flight, Flight 11, and absolutely no notification on the three other flights. And so the military was not to blame because, hey, they didn't know. As if, you know, they didn't have their own radar, and as if they weren't tuned in to all the systems that were broadcasting everything that was going on that day.
What is the significance of the memo written by Laura Brown of the FAA?
Well, she comes right out and says that what the military is saying is simply untrue. She says that when they say that we were not notified, the military was not notified, that is not true. And she says that they're saying we didn't pick up the phone and make a specific phone call. Well, first of all, she says that did happen, but more importantly, that after there's some debate about when this, what they call phone bridge first started, which is just a conference call, and that the FAA, NORAD, the National Military Command Center, and the Pentagon, and the Secret Service, and several other agencies were all on the line, and they were all talking about what was going on, and that they specifically mentioned the hijacking of Flight 77 long before the crash. And so that the military's claim that they were never notified, that's the new claim that's being made here by the 9/11 Commission on behalf of the military, that this new claim that they were never notified or that they were only notified at 9:24 or whatever it was, is simply not true, that they were notified at least, my memory's a little fuzzy here, but at least 15 minutes before that, so that there was plenty of time to do this. I don't know what will happen to Laura Brown when people find out that she not only wrote this memo, but talked to me on the telephone for about a half hour one morning and gave me some more details. I hope she will not get fired, but it's quite possible.
We are talking about the 9/11 cover-up with David Ray Griffin, who has written a second book to follow up on the new Pearl Harbor. Let's talk about Vice President Cheney and when he went underground to the conference room. Why is that important, and what is that all about?
It's important primarily in relation to Flight 93, although somewhat important in relation to Flight 77. But let me focus on Flight 93. The controversy about it is whether it was shot down. And as I reported in the New Pearl Harbor, there is abundant testimony that it was shot down by the U.S. military. We even have it from Paul Wolfowitz, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, that the plane was being followed by one or two jet military airplanes. Who had it in its sights and were ready to shoot it down if necessary. Well, the 9/11 Commission report denies all those previous stories, which were just common fare, you know, reported in the New York Times and CBS and everybody, and even Paul Wolfowitz. And so they say, no, they didn't even know that Flight 93 had been hijacked until after it had crashed. In other words, not until 10:03 or 10:06, depending on which of the disputed times you take. And the question then is, the presumption is that Vice President Cheney was calling the shots that morning. He had gone down to the the conference room, which is presidential emergency operating center in the under the White House. And the stories that have come out are that he was calling the shots and directing things, and that he had gone down there about 9:15 or 9:20. And, of course, that would have given him plenty of time then to have been in charge of directing a shoot down of Flight 93 at 10:03. So what does the 9/11 Commission do? It changes the timeline drastically. Even Cheney's own previous testimony is contradicted, as if he didn't know when he went down there. And they say he didn't go down stairs until much later, and then he lingered in the corridor between the two places, between the West Wing and the East Wing, for 20, 25 minutes, maybe a half hour, making a phone call to the president and watching things on TV and so on. So he didn't actually get into the shelter conference room until almost 10 o'clock, and so obviously it was too late for him to be in charge of anything. Well, not only does that contradict every previous story, including Cheney's own story as to when he went down there, including Richard Clark's and so on, it contradicts testimony given to the 9/11 Commission itself by Norman Mineta. Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation, had testified to the commission that he went down to the shelter conference room about 9:15, got there about 9:20, and that Vice President Cheney was already there and was clearly in charge, and he told stories that showed he had been there for a while already. The commission just blots out Norman Mineta's testimony and says, no, he wasn't down there at 9:15 or 9:20. He didn't get there down there till 9:58. That is probably it's hard to know which is the most extreme distortion in the whole book, but that certainly is a contender.
All right, David Ray Griffin, perhaps the most controversial part of this is the claims by many critics that the Pentagon, that the Bush administration had foreknowledge of the attacks, and that, in fact, they even participated in the facts. Now, I have to be honest with you. I haven't seen anything that is particularly compelling that I can even begin to put this forward. Can you make the case that, in fact, the administration did have prior knowledge?
Prior knowledge to the attacks in general?
Yes. Yeah. These planes hitting these towers. We know these two planes hit these two towers. Many critics are saying the government knew it was going to happen. Do you believe that?
Yes.
Tell us why.
First of all, there is abundant testimony, which the 9/11 Commission glosses over, simply ignores, that the administration had very specific knowledge, including from FBI agents, of the attack. So even if you thought the administration wasn't involved in the planning, that there is clear evidence that they would have known that the attacks were coming and therefore deliberately let them happen. So I go through in the book and repeat many of these facts that the 9/11 Commission ignores.
Give us some of what you think are most compelling.
Well, one of these, which the one case where the 9/11 Commission apparently thought it could bat one of these things down, so it actually mentioned it, has to do with these put options that were purchased on American and United Airlines in just a few days before 9/11. These, for hearers who don't know this, a put option is you're betting that the stock is going to plummet. And so buying a put option means that you can make an enormous amount of money if you buy a lot of them and the stock does go down drastically. Well, of course, right after 9/11, the stock on American and United did plummet. And people estimate, the estimates of how much the people who bought these options would have made run from 10 to 15 million to somewhere in a billion. So a lot of money was made that day. The 9/11 Commission tries to bat this down by saying, well, we found the agency that bought most of the United stock, the options on United, and we found that it had no conceivable relation to Al-Qaeda. So that's supposed to put the end to that. And, of course, the suppressed premise there is 9/11 was brought about entirely by Al-Qaeda. Nobody but Al-Qaeda would have known about the attacks in the advance. Therefore, if this agency had no relationship to Al-Qaeda, it couldn't have had inside knowledge. It just made a lucky purchase. But, of course, the commission didn't prove any of those premises. In fact, it didn't even argue them. It just assumed them. And, of course, my whole book is set up around the, as I said before, the two conspiracy theories. The one is that one. The other one is that the government or certain agencies, parts within the government, including quite likely the White House and the Pentagon, were involved not only in knowing about the attacks but in arranging them. And clearly that would have to be the case if the military stood down on 9/11, that would very strongly suggest that the Pentagon was involved. And then if Vice President Cheney was involved in the shoot-down order for Flight 93, that would very strongly suggest that at least part of the White House was involved.
In my very early days as a student, I was essentially studying to be a cop, an investigator. And one of the key aspects of investigation is motive. You must establish some kind of motive for a crime. Now, you spend quite a bit of time in your book dealing with possible motives of the Bush administration. You claim that the 9/11 Commission covered up the fact that the Bush administration had motives for wanting these attacks to occur. What are those motives, and why do you say the commission covered them up?
The three major motives that I and others have discussed, possible motives, were, first of all, the desire to have a pretext to attack Afghanistan in order to facilitate the building of the pipeline there for this for UNICAL, and also to establish military bases there to garner the Caspian Sea oil for the United States in future years. Secondly, the desire to attack Iraq, and I document that this goes back at least 10 years with many central members of the Bush administration. Thirdly, to jack up the military budget, and particularly the budget for the U.S. Space Command, which really means the not only the militarization of space, that has already happened, but the actual weaponization of space, putting weapons in space through which the whole planet can be dominated. And this is not paranoid fantasy. This comes directly out of the documents of the government. The federal government itself, that this is the desire to have control of space and be able to deny the use of space to other countries. And then you look at 9/11, and it was used then as the pretext for all of those things. We attacked Afghanistan about as quickly as we could get the military in shape, and this did fit with a prediction that has been widely reported, that one U.S. Official said that the war in Afghanistan would begin before the winter snows, and sure enough, it did. And that prediction had been made in July. Secondly, of course, Iraq. And thirdly, the military budget was jacked up enormously after 9/11, and particularly for the U.S. Space Command, which incidentally, Donald Rumsfeld had just before he became Secretary of Defense had just finished being the chair of the commission on the U.S. Space Command. And was asking in there, will we be wise enough to put our money into this, or will we have to wait for a space Pearl Harbor, that is, for some sort of catastrophe, before we will take action? On the very night of 9/11, rather than being in mourning or shock, Rumsfeld was on the attacking Senator Carl Levin, who had been blocking this increase in money for the U.S. military, and particularly the Space Command. And, of course, Rumsfeld got his way. Well, the 9/11 Commission mentions nothing of all this. And so the war in Afghanistan is portrayed as a humanitarian effort where we were trying to help the Afghans get back their civil rights. And the most self-interest we had was trying to keep it from being a place where terrorists could hang out. The war in Iraq is not presented as a war for oil. There is only one mention in there of oil, and it's very much a hypothetical. And there is a mention of the fact that the military budget did go up, but there's no suggestion of a causal relation or that that might have been a motive. And certainly they don't mention that this document put out by the Project for the New American Century, exactly 1 year before 9/11, which included many members who became members of the Bush administration, said in there that this effort to restructure the military and to get money for the Space Command would probably go very slowly, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, such as a new Pearl Harbor. The commission goes through and great detail talks about statements by Osama bin Laden that it says, here's proof that he had intentions that were carried out on 9/11. But here was an intention that sounds like it was carried out on 9/11 by our own government and not a word about it.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. We have been speaking with David Ray Griffin. His new book is The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Incredibly interesting. We thank you, sir, for spending the hour with us.
You're welcome, Dennis. It was good to be with you.
And Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints was the interviewer. Flashpoints is archived on the Internet, and you can find more of their wonderful programs at www.flashpoints.net. Thanks to Dennis and the Flashpoints team for that material. And you can contact this program, Unwelcome Guests, at unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, A-L-L, dot net. For Finger Lakes residents fed up with the election fraud, lies, killing, torture, and the general administration of George Bush and Richard Cheney, there are two buses leaving from the area to go to the counter-inaugural protests in Washington, D.C. on January 20th. Tickets for the Ithaca bus are $40 and are available at Autumn Leaves Used Books on the Ithaca Commons downtown. For further information on that bus, contact Ithaca_inauguration@yahoo.com. Ithaca_inauguration@yahoo.com. A bus from Rochester is being chartered by Peace Action and Education. The fare is $60 or $30 for students and the unemployed, and it will depart from Monroe Community College. For more information on that bus, telephone 585-624-3673, 585-624-3673. You can also see this announcement on rochester.indymedia.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill. then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest. With men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will cut down like an unwelcome gift.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Crazy weather and the Arctic meltdown. How are they connected? Professor Jennifer Francis. Each year in the last three decades, scientists have paid attention to the status of the ice at the end of the Arctic summer. In past years, observations from satellites and submarines have shown decreasing ice thickness and area covered for the months from June to September. That has led to an ongoing debate whether and when the Arctic might be ice-free in September. But scientists are not the only interested parties. There's growing evidence of the connection between Arctic melting and weather events in the Northern Hemisphere. Droughts, colds, heat waves, as well as flooding. Dr. Jennifer Francis is research professor at Rutgers University Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Her interests are the connections between the rapid Arctic warming and weather patterns in mid-latitudes, and impacts of Arctic sea ice loss on accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet. Dr. Jennifer Francis has a Bachelor of Science in Meteorology and a PhD in Atmospheric Sciences from the University of Washington in 1994. After coming to Rutgers, she founded and co-directed their Climate and Environmental Change Initiative. She also has direct personal experience with climate and weather, as she and her husband circumnavigated the world in a sailboat between 1980 and 1985. Jennifer Francis spoke at the New England Aquarium in the fall 2017 lecture season. Professor Jennifer Francis.
I'm sure you're all well aware that Mother Nature has just gone berserk in the last few years. We've seen all kinds of extreme weather events transpiring all over the Northern Hemisphere. All those examples all had something in common. These are all the types of extreme events that have to do with weather patterns that have become persistent. They've become stuck. So when I talk about extreme events from now on, as they're connected to the Arctic, I'm talking about the kind of extreme events that are related to very persistent weather patterns. So, for example, if it's dry for a week or two, no big deal. But if it goes on for months or even years, it can turn into a pretty significant drought. So that's the idea. All right, so I want to step back first and kind of set the stage a little bit here. I'm sure most of you here are very aware of the fact that our climate is changing. Well, you've probably heard from some people that are a little bit skeptical of what's going on right now that the climate has always changed and this is just a natural cycle. Well, let's take a look at that. Here we are looking at two graphs, two curves here. The red is what the Earth's temperature has been doing over the last 400,000 years or so. You can clearly see that it's been up and down over that time period. And those ups and downs in temperature, we understand very well what caused those. It's because of shifts in the Earth's orbit around the sun, and they're very regular. When the temperature's warm back then, that's when we had what we call an interglacial period, when the Earth was warm. And when it gets colder, and you'll notice it's only several degrees that separates those, that was an ice age. So the Earth has fluctuated back and forth between these warm periods and ice ages. Along with that, the blue curve there is showing you how much carbon dioxide there was in the atmosphere at the same time. And you'll see that they're very closely related to each other. Until you get to the present time, here we are with over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now. You can see it's nothing like it's been in approximately 500,000 years. We are completely off the chart, and we know exactly where that carbon dioxide came from. It came from mostly burning fossil fuels. What you may also notice is that the temperature hasn't caught up with that carbon dioxide yet. There's a big lag in the system. We put that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere so fast that the Earth has not had time to catch up to being in equilibrium with that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But one thing we do know is the last time we saw carbon dioxide levels this high, which was many millions of years ago, we know that the globe was several degrees warmer than it is now, and we know that sea levels were tens of feet higher. So this is where we're going. So I'm guessing that most of you know what greenhouse gases are and why we care about them, but let's just quickly review. Why do we care about this carbon dioxide so much? Well, here we have a little schematic of how the Earth's climate system works. We have the sun up there in the sky, roughly 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and we know that hot things like stars and our sun emit energy at very short wavelengths. This is the light we can see with our eyes. That very short wavelength energy penetrates right through our atmosphere, except for when it hits a cloud. Most of it makes it to the surface, and it warms the surface of the Earth. The Earth, on the other hand, is more like 60 degrees on average. And warm things also emit energy, but at much longer wavelengths. Okay, we call it infrared radiation or long wave radiation. And it just so happens that long wave radiation is absorbed by greenhouse gases. So what happens? The Earth emits this long wave energy, it's trapped by the greenhouse gases and emitted back down to the Earth. It's just like putting a blanket on the Earth, and they're there naturally. But when we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas, it's just like putting an extra blanket on your bed. It traps more heat down by the surface. So by adding so much carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, we're trapping a lot more of that heat that the Earth is emitting. All right, I said that the temperature of the Earth hasn't caught up yet to the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, but it's trying to. Over the last 17 years, we've had 16 of the warmest years on record. Let's get to the Arctic now. You might remember that the Paris Accord was aiming for 2 degrees of global warming. Well, here we are bumping up against 1.5 already in 2016. So we're getting very close to that limit that we're trying not to reach, getting awfully close. All right, but then when we go to look at the Arctic, things look very different. Here's what those same years look like in terms of the anomalies of the temperature of the Arctic. So how different those temperatures are from what they should be over these few years. Notice the scale. 1.5 is way down at the bottom. We're up here in the 6, 7, 8 degrees centigrade above normal in the Arctic. The Arctic is warming much, much faster than anywhere else on the globe. And if we look at it spatially, here we are looking down on the North Pole. You can see the USA on the left and Asia on the right. And what you notice, the warming over the Arctic is much, much larger than it is anywhere else. And you see this very interesting pattern of cooling happening in the eastern U.S. Think some of our most recent winters around here. They've been quite cold. Look over at Asia. Much colder than normal. What the heck's going on there? That's what we're going to get to the bottom of tonight. All right. How do we know that humans are responsible for this extra warming that we're seeing? Well, we have a lot of ways to figure that question out. But probably the most useful way, the most, I think, compelling way, is that we have these very good computer models, computer simulations. They're basically just a whole bunch of equations that simulate all the processes that happen in the real climate system. They make rain, they make snow, they make currents in the ocean, they make winds, they make storms. And we can use these climate models to try to look back in time and look forward in time and simulate how the Earth's climate should behave. If we do that with one of these models and we simulate what the Earth's temperature was going back in time, but we only tell the model about some of the natural changes that have happened, things like volcanoes that have erupted or changes in the solar output, things like that. So going back to, say, 1900 there, we see that the blue line is what the model is saying happened in the past, and the black line is what the real world actually did. So you can see that the model and the real world match up pretty darn well. So we have pretty good confidence in these models. However, if we continue on to near present, we get this split. The model actually thinks the Earth should be getting cooler. That's because the sun is actually getting a little weaker. And the real world is warming. So why the split? Because we didn't tell the model that carbon dioxide was increasing in the atmosphere. And if we do that and we compare the model now in red to the real world in black, we see that there's a very good match. So this is one of the ways that we can know for sure that because we're increasing greenhouse gases, we're getting this extra warming happening in the atmosphere. So, and it's not just the temperature that's changing, we're also seeing the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere increase. Over the last, well, going back to the 1970s, we've seen about a 7% increase in the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. Why would you care about water vapor? We should care a lot, because water vapor is one of the main things that fuels storms. We have more water vapor in the atmosphere. When that water vapor condenses, it releases heat, and it provides energy for storms. Of course, it also makes more rain. And what we're seeing is that over the last several decades, compared to the beginning of the century, we see that the frequency of heavy downpours and heavy precipitation events has increased dramatically, especially in the Northeast here where we live. 71% increase since, say, the 1950s or so. It's a big, big change. All right, so let's start talking more about the Arctic. Another symptom of climate change, as you, I'm sure, have heard, is that the amount of ice in the Arctic is disappearing. In particular, the sea ice. The sea ice is floating on the Arctic Ocean. Just to remind you, the Arctic is an ocean surrounded by land, whereas Antarctica is a continent with a big, huge pile of ice on top, surrounded by ocean. Two very different places. So the Arctic sea ice, we can go back and look at the last 1,500 years or so and get a pretty good idea of how much sea ice there was floating on the Arctic Ocean. How do we do that? We look at sediments in the bottom of the Arctic Ocean, and depending on what kind of critters are living in that mud, we can know whether there was light available or not, ice there or not. That's how we can reconstruct roughly how much sea ice there was. So if we do that, we see that going back about 1,500 years or so, the amount of sea ice floating on the Arctic Ocean, and this is the real estate covered by that sea ice, hasn't changed too much. It wiggles up and down a bit, but it's stayed pretty steady. Until we get to about 1960 or 70, somewhere in there. And here we see a big, big change, along with that very rapid warming that's happening in the Arctic. Big decline in the amount of sea ice. We are in uncharted territory. 2012 was the lowest amount of sea ice we've ever had in the summertime in the Arctic. That's the standing record right now. But the last few years have been very, very close to that. 2017 came in at about number 6. We're in this regime now of much, much less sea ice in terms of its aerial extent, its real estate that it covers. We've lost half in 30 years. If you take into account the thickness and you calculate the volume of that ice, we've lost 3/4 of the sea ice floating in the Arctic Ocean in only 30 years. This is just a huge change. So the question is, geographically speaking, why is the Arctic warming up so fast and not somewhere else? The reason the Arctic is warming so fast, one of the reasons, there's actually a whole bunch of reasons, but the easiest one to explain and the simplest one to understand is that when we lose all this ice that's floating on the Arctic Ocean, that ice is very bright. So when the sun's energy hits it, most of it goes right back to outer space. It never enters the climate system. It never warms anything. If we lose a bunch of that ice because of the global warming, because of greenhouse gases, then we shrink that ice. That means that's what's left there, where the ice used to be, is ocean, and it's very dark. So that ocean absorbs all that sunshine instead, warms up the water, and melts even more ice, which reflects even less of the sun's energy, which absorbs even more into the ocean, which melts even more ice. And this is something we call a positive feedback. This is the main reason. There's several other positive feedbacks that happen in the Arctic as well, but that's the main one, and it's the easiest one to explain. So, why do we care about this Arctic warming so fast? So I want you to think about a layer of air. This layer of air extends from Boston all the way up to the Arctic, all right? So we know that air expands when it warms, right? We know that it's warmer here than it is in the Arctic. So that layer of air is thicker here than it is in the Arctic. So imagine yourself sitting on top of this layer, looking towards the north. It would look like you were looking down a hill. Well, that's exactly what the air thinks too. It feels that pull downhill, just like water flowing down a mountain, and it creates a wind blowing towards the north. It's flowing down that hill in the atmosphere. But because the Earth is spinning, everything in the northern hemisphere gets turned to the right. That wind also gets turned to the right, and it becomes what we call the jet stream. And the jet stream is this ribbon of fast-moving wind high over our heads, up where the jets fly. Okay? Now, think back to Arctic amplification, the rapidly warming Arctic. What's happening? It's warming faster in the Arctic. So the thickness of that layer is growing faster up there than it is here. It's making that hill less steep. So there's less force driving that wind towards the north. We're weakening the winds of the jet stream. And when the jet stream gets weaker, it tends to take a wavier path as it travels around the northern hemisphere. It's more easily deflected from its path by things like mountains and different temperatures over the ocean and things like that. So anything that's when the winds are weaker, they're more easily deflected. And so we see these bigger north-south swings in the jet stream. So why do you care about that? Well, there are actually two effects that we need to take into account here. The first one I just told you about, where the winds are actually getting weaker. This is something we can measure. It is happening now, and we expect it to get even more so in the future. The other thing that we see happening is that those northward swings, which we call ridges, are getting longer. They're extending farther towards the north. And both of these things are important because it's causing this waviness to increase in the jet stream. So why do we care about these waves anyway in the jet stream? Well, it turns out they create our weather. So here's a typical wave in the jet stream over the United States. We see this big ridge, a northward swing over California, a dip over where we live. And the first thing you notice is that the jet stream there separates the cold air that's to the north of it from the warm air that's to the south of it. So if the jet stream is, in this case, it's just north of us, we'd be in the warm part. So we'd have warmer than normal air, all right? But the other thing is this wave in the jet stream is actually what creates the high pressures, the low pressures, the blue skies, and the storms that we experience. So in the part of the jet stream over the west in this schematic, where the winds are coming out of the northwest, is where we get nice clear sky, dry, no storms. That's been the case over California for much of the last few years, leading to their drought there. And us, over on the other side here, we've tended to be, especially in the winter, in the stormy part of the jet stream. So when the winds are coming from the southwest, bringing a lot of heat and moisture up from the Gulf of Mexico, when the pattern is like this, that's when we tend to get our nor'easters. But the point is, when these waves are really large like this, they tend to stick around a long time. This is the idea, okay? The Arctic is warming really fast, and we think it's causing these waves to get bigger, which means that they're causing our weather patterns to become more persistent. This is the basic idea. If you don't remember anything else from tonight, that's what you should remember. Okay, I'm going to end with talking a little bit about hurricanes, because they've been in the news so much this year, and a lot of people have been wondering whether there's any connection between these really bizarre hurricanes we've had this year and climate change, and maybe even an Arctic connection. Well, I'm here to tell you there's absolutely no doubt about it. There is a connection. We've seen more intense storms, we've seen more rapidly developing storms, and we've seen storms taking some very odd paths. All right? A fact. As we've already talked about, we've lost a lot of sea ice. We've also lost a lot of snow in the spring over high latitude land areas. Both of these things together are darkening the earth. We're absorbing a lot more of the sun's energy than we used to because of both of these things. Those are both Arctic things. And as a result, we're putting more heat into the atmosphere. We're putting more heat into the oceans. Heat is energy. Heat and energy are what hurricanes need to form. We're warming those oceans, we're warming the air, and we're also increasing the evaporation from the oceans into the air. And remember I said in the beginning how water vapor is increasing and how that water vapor is fuel for storms? Well, both of these things are fuel for storms. So these are adding to the strength of hurricanes. As I mentioned earlier when I talked about how the moisture had increased in the global atmosphere by about 7% or so, that extra moisture actually, when it evaporates from the ocean and goes into the atmosphere and then it condenses into clouds, goes from the vapor phase to the liquid phase, it releases heat into the air. So it warms the atmosphere. And that provides even more heat for hurricanes to feed off of. It releases its energy. And not to mention the fact that it produces a lot of rain. Okay? Another fact. The loss of land ice. So this is the ice that's sitting on top of Greenland, for example, or glaciers. That ice is sitting up on the land. So when that ice melts, it goes right into the ocean and it adds to the volume of the ocean. Right now, it's accounting for about half of the sea level rise that we've already observed. When I say half of sea level rise, I'm talking about we're measuring sea level rise increasing at some rate. Half of it is because of the melting ice. The other half is because the oceans are expanding because they're warming. Just like air expands when it warms, so does water. So that's the two halves of the total observed sea level rise. So that's another way that tropical storms, and all storms for that matter, are doing more damage. We've got a higher ocean now. The storm surges are higher than they used to be, and any storm waves are riding on a higher ocean. So these are two ways that the warming in the Arctic is helping to make hurricanes both more intense and also do more damage. What's less certain is how the Arctic might be affecting the winds that steer hurricanes. This is a topic of research, whether we're seeing these disrupted wind patterns changing the steering currents of storms. And what come to mind are Harvey and Sandy. Remember with Harvey, It came very slowly out of the Gulf of Mexico and basically parked over Houston and dumped 50 inches of rain. I mean, that's a lot of snow, but rain, it's unbelievable. And you'll remember Sandy took that crazy left-hand turn and went into New Jersey, affected us as well. There is evidence that what's happening in the summer, especially the loss of snow on high-latitude land areas, is pushing the jet stream northward. And that is leaving storms like Harvey without any wind to push them. And that's why Harvey was so stationary. I can't say that that was that the Arctic caused Harvey to be that way, but we expect to see that kind of behavior to happen more often in the future. Okay, just to wrap this up. How about 2016? 2016 was a crazy year. I already showed you that it was much warmer than any other year, but it also turns out it had a lot of extreme events. And we can look at what was happening in the Arctic when a lot of those extreme events came along. So this is a look back at the whole year of 2016, what was going on in the Arctic. The blobs of heat going all the way up into the atmosphere over the Arctic and how they evolved over that whole year. Where it's red, it's when the Arctic had an episode of heating, not just down by the surface, but all the way up through the stratosphere. It kind of comes in pulses. It's not kind of a gradual thing. And if we look at these pulses of heat and we line them up with all kinds of extreme events that happened that year, what we notice is that when we get these big pulses of heat in the Arctic, we see floods, we see snowstorms, we see cold events, we see melting events on Greenland, we see heat waves, depending on what time of year you're looking at, all sorts of extreme events. And it's not to say that extreme events can't happen other times, but there is a definite alignment of when we get these big pulses in the Arctic and these extreme events. All right, so what about the future? What are we talking about here? And what can we do about it? Well, we can use those computer models that I described in the beginning to get a handle on what might happen in the future. So here we are in the gray, looking back in time with computer models, and then from about 2005 onward is a computer simulation of the future. The black line on there is what the real world has done in terms of how much sea ice there is floating on the Arctic Ocean. So we've seen, as I showed you in the beginning, the amount of sea ice is decreasing over time. The models are able to capture that. Maybe the real world is losing ice a little faster even than the models project. But we have these different outcomes for the future, depending on what we do with emissions of carbon dioxide, getting back to the very beginning of what I talked about. So there's the real world, what's been going on. Here's what we expect to happen according to the models if we keep going the way we're going, with emitting about the same amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We're going to lose all of the sea ice on the Arctic Ocean in the summer by about the middle of the century. Pretty much all the models agree with that. But if we can reduce our emissions a lot, we'd have to almost stop emitting carbon dioxide to get this to become a solution that is one that we would like to see. But it's possible. It's possible that we can preserve that sea ice in the Arctic and give our children and grandchildren a future that isn't quite as difficult as it looks like that we're headed for now. So with that, thank you so much for being here tonight.
That was Dr. Jennifer Francis, research professor at Rutgers University, Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Her interests are the connections between rapid Arctic warming and weather patterns in mid-latitudes, particularly extreme weather events, causes and impacts of Arctic sea ice loss, and the linkages to accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet. She spoke at the New England Aquarium in the fall lecture season on October 19, 2017. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
¿Qué pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Oi Joaquin, your Bate Chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, this is Patrice Rushen. And whenever I'm in the Bay Area and I need good information and great radio, it's all about Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to bring attention to an incident that took place a few weeks ago. And it involves a community activist, somebody who does a lot of work with youth here in the city of Oakland. His name is Najari Smith. And many people who are in tune with youth activities and youth work are familiar with this story, but we want to bring it to the larger public's attention. Najari, who does a lot of bike riding and organizing around bicycling, happened to be on First Fridays, which, you know, is a very popular destination for people who actually do biking, where he was stopped and hemmed up by the police. And it's not just that he was hemmed up, but he was abused by those police officers in front of his youth. And it's something that has caused a lot of concern in the community. It was very blatant, and it's something that is now moving on to higher levels. And so, Najari, we wanted to talk to you, and we're also here with his lawyer, Walter Riley, who is also very well-known civil rights lawyer here in the city of Oakland for a long time. But let's start off with you. You know, let's talk about the incident, and we'll start off with even talking about the organizing that you do around bicycling, because that needs to be known to the public as well.
So my name is Najari Smith. We've been doing, I'm the founder and executive director of Rich City Rides. What we do is we activate people, parks, and places. We've been doing this for the past 6 years. Provided over 1,100 bikes to kids and youth and families in the community. We've done over 300 of these self-care Sunday rides that we host every week, with no problem. Playing the music as a way of gathering support, it uplifts the community, it activates the space. I'm also on the board of Red Bike and Green, which is a black cycling organization that provides safe space for black folks to get together and get healthy. So it was during this ride, and we do these rides, Red Bike and Green, we host these rides every first Friday, and we have a second Saturday ride. We've been ending it at first Fridays for what's got to be about 10 years now. And we haven't had this sort of an incident happen in all the time that we've been around.
So let's talk about this incident, the day it took place, who you were with, and what happened.
So by the time it was a collaboration between Red Bike and Green and Rich City Rides and the Scraper Bike Team. By the time we had made it down to First Fridays, there were several bicyclists already there who were anticipating us. They're used to seeing us come out there. We gathered together.
Now, let me just make sure we're clear. This was on the day of Nia Wilson's funeral, right? If I'm correct?
This was on the day of Nia Wilson's funeral.
And the bike thing was to, and I'm just trying to just understand a few things. So I didn't mean to cut you off, but just so people get some context here. And it was also the ride that day was really a way to commemorate, you know, her memory. You know, Nia Wilson, of course, the young sister who was stabbed at the MacArthur BART station. So this ride took on, you know, extra importance.
This was a very special ride. We had been planning this ride. We had been wanting to do something. We held several meetings at the bike shop at Rich City Rides, trying to figure out what was going to be our response. And we did this ride for First Friday as a healing ride in the memory of Nia Wilson. This was our Black Unity Ride Against Racism. Meeting up at the Pillars, we had a moment of silence for Nia, a beautiful moment of silence. And at MacArthur BART station, we had did our ritual circle down at Acorn. And from there, we concluded the ride as we always do at First Friday. Already a lot of folks already there at First Friday. When we came through, people welcomed our presence. Unfortunately, not everybody. There was that incident with the police.
So let me just stop one thing here. And we're talking with Najari Smith, if you're just tuning in. With Rich City Rides as a bicycling organization. He's on the board member of Red Bike and Green. For people that are listening, and, you know, I think people in the city of Oakland are very familiar with First Fridays and the crowds that it attracts. For people who don't know, we're talking about tens of thousands of people who show up on a Friday night. To get to First Fridays, all the streets are blocked off. It's almost impossible to park. So if you want to go to First Friday, one of two ways or several ways in which people get there, one of three ways. Either you live close enough to the downtown area that you can walk, which many people do, or you take Uber, which will stop you off at one of the side streets, and then you would get off and then you would walk to the rest of the way. Or you do as many people do, which is you bike. And now you have the scooters here and you take that. So there are all these Ford bikes that are on street corners throughout Oakland. On First Fridays, most of those bikes are gone because people will ride up there. You have many schools and athletes. Where we're standing at on Lakeshore Avenue, there's a biking team. They come out and we see them ride up on Friday. And then, you know, we're familiar with the rides that Red Bike and Green and others do. So bicycling up to First Fridays is a pretty common occurrence. And as you mentioned, this time it was one in which, you know, folks fresh with the memory of what happened to Nia Wilson wanted to commemorate that. So I want to give this some context so people understand that biking to First Fridays is definitely not an unusual thing, but in fact, an activity that the city of Oakland, that it now has, you know, put bike lanes throughout the city, has encouraged folks to do bike and bike off. And so here you are at First Fridays and, you know, with your youth. So what happened then?
So I'm at First Fridays with my youth and I was racially profiled. They could have stopped. There was so many other things happening at that spot at First Friday, but the officer chose to stop. I mean, I don't know whether we was too happy to, you know, we were able.
I take your time on this a little bit. It's you know, when people get hemmed up by police and abused,
it stays with you.
It stays with you. And, you know, you can't see Najari, but he's shaking up a little. And this has happened, you know, a few weeks ago. Walter, maybe you can add a little bit to this as, you know, Najari gets some of his thoughts together.
Yeah. I want to also point out that this is First Friday. There is music in the streets. There are bands in the streets. There are various folks playing instruments up and down the street. Lots of noise. And every musical event on First Friday can be heard more than 50 feet away.
Yeah, many of us have DJed there. I mean, you know, there you are. You know, that's what it's about.
And you have, in this context, with lots of people on the street and in the intersection where the stop occurred, there are lots of folks. So Najari and his group, plus the other bicycle groups, came down from MacArthur Park in a celebration of the life of Nia Wilson, a memorial for Nia Wilson, as a visual for Nia Wilson. And they arrived with both young people and some older people. That biking group is from, Najari told me, from sometimes 4 years old to 80 years old, historically. They've been doing this for years on First Friday. The police officer who's in charge of First Friday should be aware that this biking group arrives there every First Friday. And that this biking group is supported by the people of Richmond and other bikers and people in the Bay Area as a very healing group. This is healing in the spiritual way that Najari and the people around him are much involved in. Their approach is to teach, to learn self-respect, dignity for through the training and participation as community. Building community is what this group is about, and building community is what was either consciously attacked or inadvertently attacked. But the nature of racism in our society is that when we are attacked, what we stand for, what we're a part of, is also under attack. This is institutional.
So the way that I understand the story, and which is the way we got it across, is that there was somebody who wrote about it and described that an officer stopped and demanded that you turn down your music, which is what you had in First Friday. And we were told that you did turn down your music, but that was not enough for that officer. So can you describe to us what took place?
Let me describe what I know, and I'm still working on the investigation because it's my client, and I don't want my client talking about this specific incident. That's just the nature of the way I work, the law work, and criminal defense work. But Najari arrived there with a lot of folks at the intersection. They did a ritual circle. The traffic is stopped, as anybody who's been the First Friday know, and you and I and others know, that traffic is stopped while people cross through the intersection. They did a ritual ride. All the bikers that were able to did the ritual ride, and they came out of the ritual ride at a certain point. And when they came out of the ritual ride is when the police officer walked up to Najari. He didn't say halt. He didn't say stop. He didn't say, I want to talk to you. What we know is that he grabbed the bike's handlebars. I'm saying that that is a violation of proper police conduct. And if it's proper in Oakland, then Oakland policy is wrong. And that's what we want to investigate. We will pursue this. Legally, we will pursue this as political organizations. Why a police officer feels it's okay to approach an organized group of people this way, pick out the black person who they maybe think is the leader, knowing that there are other folks with them, and act in a manner that could incite the situation, could provoke more responses. But because of Navari tried to keep people cool, we know he held up his hand and said to people, don't engage, and he himself wanted to know why this was going on, why he was being stopped. The police officer did not engage in the conversation with him. The police officer simply wanted to say, I'm going to identify you and give you a citation. And there was no conversation about that. Now, we might say that a police officer is entitled to do that. That doesn't mean it's right.
But you wound up spending a weekend in Santa Rita Jail. That's where everybody is upset. How does a bike ride with somebody who rides with youth, who's done this dozens of times, who's at First Fridays, wind up with everything that's going on at First Friday, wind up being in jail for a weekend?
I want Najari to talk about the Orwell instance, but again, what happened is he said to the police officer, what's going on, basically. He wanted to know what's going on. And the police officer said, if you don't give me ID, you're going to be arrested. And he asked Najari to follow him. Najari went with him. And I think that was an excellent time for him to explain to Najari. But instead, he handcuffed Najari. I believe they handcuffed him before they got to the car. I'm looking for video, more video study to understand what exactly happened. But he found Najari's ID before he pulled him away from the scene. So he has Najari's ID, and he could have given him a citation and left and let Najari go. But he didn't. And why he didn't is what I want the city of Oakland to question. I want the citizens of Oakland to question, and I want the police review board to question. After that, Najarian was taken to Santa Rita, where he had to bail out the confiscated his bike, impounded his bicycle and equipment. That, I'm saying, is unnecessary. Whether they had been told by the commander to do it or not, that was something that we want to investigate, but is improper. There needs to be a better approach to dealing with people in our community. Whether they are upstanding or not, they have to be dealt with. In this particular case, this is an upstanding member of the community that was improperly handled and contacted by the police department.
Well, as I said, you know, when word of this incident got out, it was very upsetting for a lot of people. And obviously, you're still, Najari, who's standing here, still, you know, upset about this. What would you add about this? You know, we're talking about this, and I think one of the, you know, concerns is looking at this not as an isolated incident, which I think oftentimes these types of scenarios are made out to be, but something that is a little bit more systemic. And what I mean by that is that I know that when they had critical mass and all those things, that is kind of, you know, we recognize that. We understand that bicyclists are going to come out. Bike lanes are here, and bikers have the right of way. We also know that, you know, for a very long time, a lot of the folks, you know, I remember the scraper bikers and others, are often cited, given tickets, and harassed in a place that now is pushing, you know, the green economy. Folks need to, you know, ride rather than take a bike, and people are doing that, but yet the freedoms are not allowed. So I'm just, you know, your thoughts on just some of this right now, Najari.
It touches on Rich City Rides, our brand of transit advocacy, which is more than bike lanes. It's about making sure that the streets are safe, that we have that we're able to travel from place to place, from home to church to the park, to our neighbor without being harassed. You know, I was stopped on a bicycle, but us as black people, we get stopped for walking, we get stopped for our driving, we get stopped on the BART. And there's something in that policy that needs to be changed where we don't have to feel unsafe by just living while black.
Walter, let me ask you this, and Najari as well. In San Francisco, maybe about a year and a half ago, we saw the police department start to enforce these rules around bicycles. They were citing everybody. They were pulling people over, and they were saying that they weren't stopping at the red lights. And we saw the bike community come out. We saw that there was intense criticism and lobbying efforts made. You know, and the end result was people backed off. Like, this was not going to be tolerated. Bicyclists, you know, sure, you're going to have to obey the rules, but you are not going to be pulling over, you know, folks riding their bikes like this, which is, you know, what the conclusion was. We see here in the city of Oakland that rules are heavily enforced if you're driving. If I'm driving on this street where we see these bike lanes, and I'm not making way for these bicycles, I will get a ticket. And, you know, that's been made very clear that this is a priority. So with that in mind, what has been the response from the larger biker community knowing what has happened to Najari? You know, this situation went viral on the Internet. And so have those forces that, you know, went up and jammed up San Francisco, which, you know, advocated for bike lanes here and insist that we have this green economy and you know, and drive less. What has been their collective response to the community? And now that we have a police commission, what has been their response to this?
Well, I have not heard from the police commission. That's in response to your last question. There have been a couple of city council members that have tried to find out more about it. Rebecca Kaplan, Lynette McElhaney has obviously done something. I expect that we're going to hear more from Desley Brooks in giving support for what we are trying to do around this. My intent, the group intends to reach out to folks. The larger biker community, I have not had the response that I thought we would get immediately, but I do expect there's going to be a larger community. What has been gratifying is that a lot of black folk have turned out. Black biker, black organizations, and those organizations are often mixed. And that's growing. an organization is growing out of this in response. But what we do know is that when the community supports, when the organized bikers get involved, they make changes. They're making changes across the country. We want bike lanes and bike safety, not just to benefit the upper echelons or the people moving up. We want to represent people in our community. And I know that when bikes were being installed around the city, you, Davey D, among others, but you made a big push to get them in black communities, to get them in other places. And it's not clear they would have been there had not been an outcry. We need outcry organization lobbying around all of these efforts. Najari, the bikers, are part of the ecological movement. They are part of the movement, the green movement. They're going to be part of the March of 1,000 Grandmothers, et cetera, next week, a couple of weeks from now. Najari can talk more about that. But they're part of a larger movement. That larger movement has to come out in the interest of black people and black and a black cause right now, and not just have us be an appendage to what they do. And they don't do it unless we call them out on it. And that's what we're doing right now.
Walter Riley, civil rights lawyer, that's his voice. We have Najari Smith. One last question as we kind of wrap up here, Walter. The police, Oakland police, who have been under federal decree and what have you, did they have body cameras on? Have you been able to see the footage? I mean, what was the situation with respect to that? Do we know the officer's name? You know, they've been doing a lot of the barbershop talks and, you know, and these attempts to build community relations with the nose channels. What's been the response knowing that? And in particular, since we do have, you know, folks from you know, these police departments that have gone to these communities, even on this block that we're at, the police have come up here and they've done a meet a cop with coffee type of event. So, with this community outreach, what has been the response from those participants? And have we seen footage and, you know, and folks who are saying they want to build a bridge? What have they been talking about?
I'm glad you asked that question, because just this morning, just before Najari and I got here, we did look at some footage. There's more footage that I want to look at. There's more I want to ask for, because I have not seen the approach to Najari and why the officer approached Najari. I have a police report that I just got last night. Doesn't explain very much, but it does explain that Najari was identified before he left the scene. They had his identification. The footage that we see shows that Najari was approached by the cop's hands on the bicycle, and they were not in the middle of the intersection when this happened. It also shows that Najari was saying, "What's going on?" You know, in various words, what is happening here? And I'm not comfortable with just you approaching me and stopping me. And I think that a citizen has a right to say what's going on. We've seen footage of folks asking the police officers why they are stopping them. We've seen footage of black folk being shot for doing that. We've seen footage of white people being told, you know, whatever they given answers, whatever they want, and not being arrested. Black people don't have that kind of privilege in this society, apparently. We want to challenge the police department. We want to challenge the city of Oakland. We want policy changes. And we are going to engage. There will be some discussions about how to approach this. We are having collective discussions with the other bikers. There are bikers from Chicago that are interested. There are probably bikers from across the country that want to be engaged in this discussion. Hopefully we can keep this going. But we want to talk about policy changes and approaches towards black people. The kind of respect that critical mass gets when they ride, we want critical attention given to what happens when black people ride. Now, Najari has been involved in building parks, building communities. I mean, just you can talk about some of those things around building self-respect, dignity, and understanding.
Yeah, just Google them and you'll see the work.
Absolutely.
It speaks for itself.
Absolutely. It's all there. But we want people to pay attention, to come out. We still have to go to court on Friday, the 31st, as it stands right now, around the vehicle charge. The district attorneys decided not to press charges on the resisting arrest, which I don't think there is a basis for it. I don't think there's a basis for the vehicle code charge. But as this moment, having had contact with the police department, that charge has not been withdrawn. We still have to show up in court. We want people there. We want large numbers of people there. We want people Googling, writing statements on blogs. We want people making noise around this kind of thing, because we want to support this group, this man, and the women who are with him, who are saying we are building dignity and self-respect in our communities. We are not primarily about confrontation, but if there is confrontation, the community is with you.
Real talk, Walter Riley. We appreciate it. Najari, any last comments from you, you know, that you would like the people that are listening to understand?
That we need to build this coalition around having this policy change. That we all need to come together for all of us. My organization is going to be a part of the Solutions to Solidarity Summit that's happening in the Bay Area for the week of action, the second week of September. Another thing that my organization does is we educate the public on how government politics work. We have a workshop. It's called The Government Takeover. It's happening September 7th at the Building Blocks for Kids office. We're going to go into how the elected officials work with city staff to move the city forward and how we influence that. I'm asking everybody to come out, all cycling organizations, all of our allies, all of our people, for August 31st. We're going to be out there as early as 8 a.m., as late as 10 p.m. We're going to have speakers coming out from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and we ask you all to join us.
And where are you asking them to go?
This is going to be at the Wiley Emanuel Courthouse in Oakland on 7th Street. You can look up Rich City Rides at www.richcityrides.org. Feel free to email info@richcityrides.org for more information. Look us up on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're there. And stay involved.
Well, there you have it. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. Najari Smith from Rich City Rides, thank you very much. Civil rights attorney Walter Riley, thank you very much. And hopefully people keep their eyes and ears listening. And hopefully the larger biker community, you know, bike community that is, you know, raise the ruckus to make sure we have bike lanes and raise the ruckus to make sure that folks who are bicycling are kept safe and are able to move about this city freely and be unimpeded. Step up and be representative for this gentleman who has long been organizing folks around biking, but long before there were bike lanes and even proposals for it. His record speaks for itself, and I think this is a critical moment, not just for the city of Oakland, but those who are activists and who live in the city who have, you know, purported that they want to have, you know, a green economy and a green landscape. Well, if that's being impeded for certain populations, that needs to change, and we hope everybody steps up. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I hard times like yeah, bad trips like yeah. Nazareth, I'm f***ed up, homie, you f***ed up, but if God got us, then we gon' be all right. And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the face down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. But pretty Benjamin is the highlight. Now tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy. Tell them all to come and get me, reaping everything I sow. So my karma come in heaven, no preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a f***ing gangsta in silence for the record. Tell the world I knew it's too late. I think I've gone crazy. Trying to side my vices all day. Won't you please believe when I say, when you know we've been hurt, been down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
All right, we gon' be all right, huh? We snowshoe, a car, 40 acres and a mule, a piano, a guitar, anything. See, my name is Lucy, I'm your dog. Mother, you can live at the mall. I can see the evil, I can tell it. I know it's illegal, I don't think about it. I deposit every other zero, thinking of my partner. Put the candy, painting on a Rico, digging in my pocket. And a profit big enough to feed you. Every day my logic, get another dollar just to keep you in the presence of your Chico. I don't talk about it, be about it. Every day I seek you. If I got it, then you know you got it. Heaven, I can reach you. Pet dog, pet dog, pet dog, my dog, that's all. Pick back and chat, I trap the back for y'all. I rap, I black on tracks, so rest assured. My rights, my wrongs, I write till I'm right with God. When you know, we've been hurt, been down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po, when the killer's dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.